boy spy Dow Jones. Brainwash by the FTSE, NASDAQ and secure loans. Brainwashed us in Brussels, brainwashing us in Bonn. Brainwashing us in Washington, Westminster in London.
But whatever. All right. This is a phone-in talk show, and I, strangely, every once in a while, I don't know why, actually, why would I think it's so strange? I mean, I think a lot of you have listened for a long time, anything from a few months to a few years to a lot of years. But then we always get people that say they are just tuning by. They're on the Internet. WRIF.com, streaming live across the world. And, of course, this program, The Night Call Show, with me, Peter Werby, at 313-298-WRIF. It's unusual, because I have politics to the left of Mussolini. Remember Mussolini? That was that fascist ally of Hitler during World War II. I got to believe everyone knows who he is. Usually, if you have politics to the left of Mussolini, they don't let you on the radio. So that's why we're getting people from all around the country. And if you want to join the program, you can either call 313-298-WRIF if you're anywhere in the United States, or I suppose anywhere in the world. But You could also email us at, let me see, we got so many email addresses now, don't I? Nightcall@wrif.com. Nightcall, and it's all one word, of course, nightcall@wrif, like in Frank, .com. And we'll read some of the emails. Best, I know a lot of times you got a lot to say, so you write like 1,000 words, and I cannot edit that by eye. So the best thing to do is to write maybe 6 or 8 sentences, tops. If you want to write longer things, I'll read it, but I'm not going to read it until tomorrow. In fact, I'm going out of town tomorrow. I'm going to drive to Washington, D.C. There's a big anti-Bush, anti-Iraqi occupation march that's going to happen next Saturday. My wife and I are taking off a little earlier, just kind of see the sights and what have you, visit some relatives. And if you want to see more about that, you go to my website, peterwerby.com. That's PETERWERBE.com, WERBE.com. And if you go to some of the links and then go back, you'll probably get my new website that's not even finished. We're kind of redoing this. So thanks to, can I say your name? I guess I can. Bill Stuber and Will Stuber and Bill West, who are, and that's the kind of family you get because of the internet. Will's in Philadelphia, Bill's in Bellingham, Washington. Oh, that's all right to say, guys. You know, I know you're kind of behind the scene, folks. So, well, nobody's calling. You know, actually, I'm going to do that. I've been talking about the Iraq War and the occupation almost every single Sunday for the last, I don't know how many months, because really, it in many ways, it's the defining moment of this era. And you don't realize, friend of mine, let me see who was. No, he's not even, he's a high school teacher. No, that's right, he's a college professor. And he says that to his students always, his freshman students, he said, Do you think you're living in history right now? And each, almost every one of them kind of looks at him peculiarly. And, I mean, they don't even know what to answer. Never even thought about it. Well, of course, every moment we live is history. And this war will go down in history. And history will make its judgment. And that's why, to some extent, that I ask you, don't make real fast judgments just based on what you last heard on the medium, or the media now. It's going to be a little more diverse, and they're actually beginning to criticize Bush, aren't they? And this fool's errand that Bush is wasting American lives and American treasure and killing thousands of Iraqis in the process. So that's what I would say normally with this kind of stuff. At least hold back. That's not the best thing to do. The best thing to do is find out all the information. Not just rely on the corporate press, the conservative media, for all of your information. Because you're going to get one side of it all. And there's lots of sides. Some people read it all and then come up with a different opinion than mine. And they've got a lot of things to cite and they say, well, here's why I'm right. But you really are just kind of a corporate clone. If you just repeat the last headlines you heard on the Fox News, that's a joke, a Fox, what do we call it then? The foxhole news about the war in Iraq. So this, all of this, for one thing, it hasn't all played out. Who knows? Who knows what's going to happen? I mean, this could break the bank. I mean, Bush has already driven us into deficit. So now we're a deficit nation. And when the United States is going to spend $87 billion. Well, they've already spent all of our tax money on so many things that are worthless and not really for us, the people that pay the bills. And so here's another $87 billion. $60 billion of it, of course, is going to go over to Bush's palace. Wait a minute, let me just see if I can... Sorry for all this noise here. In fact, it says it here on the website. Cost to U.S. taxpayers for destroying Iraq, $60 billion. Cost to U.S. taxpayers for rebuilding Iraq, $87 billion. 87 plus, of course. So that's like $150 billion that you and I worked our cans off in shops, in factories, in offices, in hospitals, and stuff like that. And, of course, now we know that that all this weapons of mass destruction stuff was just a total load of crap. And there's a State Department study that as early as March 2002 was already planning for the occupation of Iraq. No one mentioned anything about us being threatened or that Iraq trying to destabilize the region in which it is located. there was just a decision of these imperialists, men who desire the United States not to be a nation but an empire, to control directly what they make a fortune off of by ripping us off here at the gas pump, for instance. Well, now it's what? It's up to $1.63 again? Pardon me. Here's what Anita Danks says. Anita Danks is the research director with the National Priorities Project. And you can go to nationalpriorities.org to see this. The president's request for $87 billion for war and occupation, if spent on other priorities, could pay for. Now, remember, this is not going to the Iraqi people. And the Iraqi people, for this illegal, unnecessary war, deserve reparations to repair their country for what Bush did to it. But here's and also, it's all borrowed. So now it's $87 billion plus all interest, like credit card. This is like people that are maxed out on their credit card. The United States is maxed out on its credit card. And you know who's going to pay for it? Particularly you folks that are listening that are 17, 18, 19 years old. But it also means that we don't have the wherewithal to let our senior citizens retire. So it means that seniors, because we don't have an adequate enough money to let people after years of hard work, of wage labor, we don't have the ability in this country to let them live the life that they deserve of retirement. So this paltry sums that are given to our seniors, a lot of them are now going back and becoming associates at some anti-union, you know, chain. So here, if the $87 billion would have been spent here in the United States, I didn't finish the thought, but I've said this before, $60 billion for the Army, and now they're talking maybe they can cut it down to $50,000 by 2005 or something like that. So it's $60 billion for the armed forces, $27 billion for reconstruction. Well, we know where all this is going, right? We know where this money is going. Here, New York Times business section. Halliburton, that's Cheney's company, the vice president. And they're questioning whether Halliburton, Cheney's company, which is still paying him money, by the way, is overcharging the United States government in the procurement of gasoline and other fuel for Iraq, which is now importing oil products to stave off shortages. What's happening, according to two lawmakers, Halliburton has charged the government $1.62 to $1.70 a gallon for gasoline that could be bought wholesale in the Persian Gulf region for about 71 cents, transported to Iraq for no more than 25 cents. The fuel was sold in Iraq for 4 cents to 15 cents a gallon. You and me, we're going to the pump now, and we're again paying $1.63 a gallon. Halliburton is charging the government up to $170 a gallon, and it's selling the fuel to the Iraqis for between 4 cents and 15 cents a gallon. Are you getting this? And we're paying for this. So we're paying twice. You've just worked 55 hours in an office, and of course when you're on salary, you don't get any more than the 40. Or you just busted your butt in some small shop at some crappy non-union wages, and a third of that is being taken out, given to Halliburton so they can overcharge the U.S. government and charge the Iraqis 4 cents to 15 cents a gallon for fuel and gasoline. Is this cool? Is this what you people say? Oh, that's because Saddam, like that. Come on, man, it's a racket. You're the pigeon. We all are. I'm the pigeon. We're the mark. It's a monstrous racket. All right? Where was that? I was going to tell you what this all could have been spent on. How do these things disappear so quickly? Oh, here it is. All right. So you got $87 billion. We're borrowing it from foreign bankers, you 17, 18, 19-year-olds. That's part of what your future is going to be, paying back these banks that are loaning George Bush money so he can pay his corporate pals to overcharge the current taxpayers. You're paying that, or your parents are paying that. Plus, you're going to pay that back in, you know, the interest back out of your wages in the future. Now, I haven't used this phrase in a long time, but do you think what I'm saying is a lie? Is this just a lie that I'm saying? That I'm twisting the facts? That what I'm saying isn't true? Or do you say, it's all right, yes, sir, it's okay, whatever you want to do, just take all my money, take my parents' money. Damn. If we put it in the United States, you know, Bush has presided over the loss of 2.5 million jobs, another result of his mismanagement of the economy. So if we decided to spend $87 billion here for war and occupation, instead if we took $15 billion for school construction, gee, what an idea. Have nice schools for our kids all over the country to go to school in. That could result in 356,000 jobs here in the United States. 105 new affordable housing units could create 258,000 jobs. $15 billion for local and state roads could create almost 500,000 new jobs. How about some school teachers? Do you know that people are trying to teach classes in some big cities with almost 40 kids in a class? 40 kids in a class. I mean, they can't do it. If we hired 221,000 new school teachers, that's what we could do with part of the money. How about 84,000 new firefighters and health coverage for 5,700,000 people? And one of the things that you do, if you go to my website, peterwerbe.com, P-E-T-E-R-W-E-R-B-E.com, and there's a counter on there. Well, there's two counters. One's counting down to when George W. Bush leaves office on January 20th, 2005. But and it's, you get it by the second, minute, hour, or whatever. You know, all the hours. And what's the other one? Oh, yeah, it's the cost of the war. And if you click on that, wherever you are, in the state here or across the country, well, not around the world, but if you go to that website, you can see exactly what this is costing us. Yeah. So it's not a matter of, oh, you know, I think we should kick Saddam Hussein's ass, you know. That's not what it's all about. All right, a couple of other issues. When I said I wasn't going to talk, you know, I told my wife, I said I'd talk about Iraq every week. I'm not going to do it. But I did it. Let's see. The Supreme Court is going to decide the Pledge of Allegiance case. This is where an atheist parent said, I think that the Pledge of Allegiance, because it had these right wingers stuck the phrase "under God" in the Pledge of Allegiance in the 1950s, they didn't want anyone to think we were godless communists. They wanted to distinguish us from the atheistic Soviet Union, so they took this Pledge of Allegiance that had been around for about 60 or 70 years and put "under God" in it. Now, this atheist parent who said, I didn't want my atheist daughter being subjected to this religious utterance, he sued, and it was upheld by a district court, and it's been upheld by an appellate court. Now the Supreme Court of the United States is going to take it on. And, you know, I really dislike any enforced patriotism and certainly any enforced recognition of religion. But I predict that it'll probably be upheld. The most far right wing, to the point where he's a right wing wacko, Antonin Scalia, one of the people that stole the 2000 election for the Bush mob, he excused himself. Well, they used to call it just excuse himself. Now they call it recuse for some reason. I don't know why. Anyways, he has made so many public utterances of his right-wing religious fanaticism that he actually, you have to compliment the man. He took himself out of it because the Supreme Court justices aren't supposed to make public utterances about cases in front of them, and he's done it all over the place. I mean, this guy barely believes in democracy. Now, why shouldn't we have "under God" in there? Well, do you remember we've talked about this before when this first came up? This Pledge of Allegiance was written by a Christian minister, Francis Bellamy. And Francis Bellamy wrote this somewhere in the 1890s. And let me see if I can even remember it. I probably could if I wasn't on the air. Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the nation for which it stands, one nation, under God, as it says now, as this was put in the 1950. One nation, under God, indivisible. See, a lot of this was still about the Civil War. Some people, you know, you get kids saying, they're saying invisible. Indivisible means that the nation cannot be divided like the South attempted. So, I mean, a lot of this isn't even, with liberty and justice for all. Now, Bellamy wanted to, now let me give you, for you right-wingers who think you've captured all these symbols of patriotism, Reverend Francis Bellamy was a Christian, ready for this? Socialist. That's right. He was involved in what they called the social gospel, and he believed in socialism as well as Christianity. He said that that socialism was rooted in the gospels and what have you, and he was going to add equality with liberty and just, yeah. But I mean, he thought that it probably would make it unacceptable because in the 1890s, this country was so unequal in terms of racial considerations with you know, mob terrorist rule in the South and, you know, segregation and all that. In fact, this is, remember, we were talking about that, too. All of these symbols of, appears to be conservative and right-wing patriotism, in so many of them, have been penned by left-wing people, beginning with the Pledge of Allegiance in Reverend Francis Bellamy. Then there's America the Beautiful, written by a lesbian. Yeah, you can just eat that up, right-wingers. The slogan on the Statue of Liberty that no longer applies. Give me, you know, give us your, can't remember, your huddled masses or whatever. We don't want them anymore. No more huddled masses, please. Just give us middle-class white people. Don't want anybody coming in from Latin America or Africa, especially Africa, or Asia or any place like that, you know. In fact, we don't even want Poles or Irish in here, which I believe, no, is that the largest number? I don't know. Anyways, in terms of illegal immigrants, I think mostly Mexican nationals, and then somewhere right up there are Poles and Irish. Anyways, what else? Oh, yeah, how about that nice, this land is your land, this land is my land. Oh, everybody singing that, flags waving. Woody Guthrie, real close to the Communist Party, and on his guitar it said, "This machine kills fascists." That was World War II and all that. Anyways, I think the Supreme Court will uphold the idea that it's okay to put under God in there. It's absolutely meaningless. You know, one nation under God? What does that mean? What does that even mean practically? We recognize that we're under God, and then what? I mean, all the corruption, all the lies that come out of, you know, not just the White House, but so many political venues. I mean, I have no idea. If you ever look at that, what does that mean on the money? See, that's going to say, look, it's on the money. And it's not establishment of religion. That's what the First Amendment says. Congress shall establish no religion. And they're going to say this is kind of a general civic recognition of something. It does seem like establishment of religion to me, but whatever. You know, the money says, in God we trust. What does that mean? What does that really mean? We trust in God. Trust in God to do what? I mean, all sorts of things happen that are pretty horrific, from hurricanes to September 11th. I mean, so what's the practical function of trusting in God to the point where it's emblazoned on your money, or people almost always, you know, are forced to say the Pledge of Allegiance, and then they recognize that this is one nation under God? What does that mean? I don't know. You tell me. Supreme Court, can we take our hats off to these guys and one woman? Usually we can. The Supreme Court last Tuesday rejected an appeal by the Bush government that jeopardized state medical marijuana laws that allow ill patients to smoke pot if they get a doctor's recommendation. The Bush administration requested the justices to consider whether the federal government can punish doctors for recommending or even talking about the benefits of marijuana to sick patients. Now, Bush, you got to remember, under this lunatic loser, this is John Ashcroft. He, in 2000, remember, he was the guy, he was running for senator from Missouri, and he lost to a dead man, Mel Carnahan, the governor, crashed in a plane. And people said, I'd rather vote for a dead man than John Ashcroft, because John Ashcroft is a flipped-out right-wing wacko who is into the most punitive measures possible, particularly when it comes to medical marijuana. So he wants to take sick and dying people and make criminals of them. They're not patients. Oh, well, I have AIDS, or I'm dying of cancer, or something like that. And if I smoke marijuana, it's okay. Sorry, you are a criminal. So fortunately, the Supreme Court rejected the appeal of the Bush government. I mean, here are these guys, you know. I mean, Bush was like, you know, snorting up half of Peru when he was a party dog during his wild days. It's all right if you're Republican, right? You can snort coke, you can, you know, harass women, you can gangbang them, you know, what else? You can lecture everybody on faltering morals and then turn out to be a mega gambler like this guy, what was his first name, Bill Bennett, and all of that. Anyway, so thank you, Supreme Court, for doing that. Right, a lot of you want to talk. All right. Hey, you got to have a turn too, so let's do it. Peter Werby's my name. I'd like to hear from you. 313-298-WRIF. Hi, this is Night Call. Welcome to the show. Hey, you with me? You are not. All right. Yeah, people, you know, we've talked about this. Rick Fox is our producer and phone screener, and we realize that we are dealing with ADD people, since that's what we are. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening. Wait a minute. Do I not have every, you know, he's got this, all right, there's only one way to check this. I'm going to put this person on hold. We'll see here. No, they're just dropping off. Okay. Where would you like to go next? Thank you very much. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air.
Hey, good evening, Peter. How are you? My name is Daniel Streeter.
Hi, Daniel.
I've been actually spending the last 8 months working on a graduate thesis in regards to weapons of mass destruction. This may sound like a crazy theory, but I have a little evidence to back it up.
What's that?
What if there were no weapons of mass destruction at all?
Where?
In Iraq.
Well, there weren't.
Well, my theory is on this is that after we won the war the first time, we knew there were no weapons then. Saddam, everyone kept trying to say that, you know, Saddam had them, but if he didn't have them, why wouldn't he let the inspectors in? He let the inspectors in. They couldn't find anything.
Right.
The reason he made himself cagey is after World War II, when we went into Japan and we dropped both bombs, why didn't we let Japan know we didn't have any more? Because it gave us an edge.
Well, the same thing. I mean, Saddam, the reason that people in that region, including Iran, the reason that they want weaponry is as a hedge against the only nuclear power in the region, which is Israel, and also against the United States, because they know if you have nuclear weapons or weapons of mass destruction, then you don't get invaded. I'm sorry. If you have them, what am I saying? If you have them, you don't get invaded. If you don't have them, you do get invaded.
After the war in 91, after we decimated Saddam's forces,
right.
The only strategic edge that man had left was the thought that the most powerful nation in the world said that they had weapons of mass destruction.
Mm-hmm.
Just the thought that they had them, because the United States obviously said they did, may have kept Iran out of their borders, Syria and other Arab nations where they had had previous problems with.
That's very interesting. That's extending it even more so. Yes, you're probably right. The United States and Britain never would have invaded Iraq if they believed there was even a chance that they had significant any weapons of mass destruction.
And the most powerful nation in the world told the rest of the world that this man has biological weapons.
Yeah.
And that basically gave Saddam a psychological nuke that kept his enemies at bay.
Well, he had little options. He knew what was on the table. He knew that the Bush regime had longstanding intentions, even when they were out of power, to overthrow his government and establish an imperial outpost for his oil buddies. And it was only a matter of time unless they could kind of bluff. So, but the bluff was running out, but it was running out for Bush as well, because as this State Department aide to Colin Powell has come out recently and said that Powell himself lied at the United Nations. He knew there were no weapons of mass destruction, that everything he was presenting was a lie. But it was going to become clear if even they waited a month. See, everybody knew this. This was kind of like the emperor with no clothes. But even the countries that opposed the war, like France and Russia and some of the other countries, they didn't want to say as blatantly that this was just this lie made up by Bush for political and geopolitical reasons. So what they were afraid of is that if they waited one more month, that's, you know, the evil Jacques Chirac, the man who caused French fries to become freedom fries, he said, let's wait 30 days. Let's wait 30 days and see what the inspectors come up with. George Bush, compounding the lie, you know, creating this, playing on our fears, about September 11th and related terrorist acts, said, we're in immediate danger, imminent danger. We are going to suffer direct attack if we don't move unilaterally and internationally illegally to attack and destroy the Saddam Hussein regime. Because what Bush was frightened of was twofold. First and foremost, that the inspectors would say there are no weapons of mass destruction, because there's not. And the second thing he was really frightened of was the mass movement of opposition. So the first time the people spoke in this enormous voice internationally to say no to war in Iraq, and they couldn't allow that. Just like now, they're looking at what's happened in Bolivia. This is the first major victory. People, Bolivia, say, what the hell is this guy talking about? Bolivia, the people of Bolivia, the miners, the indigenous Inca people, even the middle class, said no to the kind of oppressive looting sponsored by the United States, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Trade Organization that has made conditions in the poorest country in South America, Bolivia, even worse. And they were able to force the president to resign and virtually brought the country to a standstill. We had kids in Seattle in 1999 bring a World Trade Organization meeting to a close because they would say, look, this is about elite domination, elite control. It's going to destroy the environment more. It doesn't recognize workers' rights or women's rights or environmental concerns. And they successfully stopped a meeting. The people of Bolivia stopped the World Bank's programs and this particular program to further loot the country of Bolivia dead in its tracks. And this is a wonderful victory. Thank you, Daniel. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Hi, this is Night Call. You're on the air.
Yeah, how you doing, Peter?
Doing good, man. Where are you? Outside?
I'm hauling cars for General Motors. I've been listening to your show for a long time now, 15 years or more. I'm having a hard time dealing with what's going on right now, this Iraq thing and the president. I don't understand why we're not, the United States have, people of the United States haven't stood up and called for his head. You know, they were going to impeach Clinton for a Hummer, and he's killed thousands of people. Cost billions of dollars, and he's still in office. It just doesn't make sense to me. I knew we were in trouble when he stole the election from Gore, and I just wanted to make my comment on that tonight. And also, I have a really good friend that's Republican.
Yeah.
She's a dear friend of mine, and she got caught up listening to Rush Limbaugh and that other guy, Bill O'Reilly, and stuff like that. And I just asked her the other day. I said, I'm really curious to sit down and think. Write down, I made it easy on her. I said, write five good things that President Bush has done for this country since he's been in office. Positive things that he's done for this country. And then, you know, I'll listen to what you had to say by the garbage shows that she listens to and happens to watch.
You know, actually, I can imagine. Let me ask you a question, though, when it comes to, like, people that listen to Rush Limbaugh. You have any friends or do you know anybody or, unfortunately, maybe even family members that were really stoners, you know, that just abused drugs or alcohol so badly that it actually affected their lives and what have you? I have. Have you?
Oh. Yeah,
well, now that's the leader, the most foremost spokesperson for the conservative ideology in America is a guy whacked out on OxyContin. So who the hell can ever take him seriously again? All right, thanks a lot.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Peter will be back to take more calls right after this.
It's Taco Bell's Zesty Chicken Bowl. We don't prepare it until you say, give me a Zesty Chicken Bowl.
Somebody say a Zesty Chicken Bowl? Coming right up.
Hey, pal, we're making a commercial here.
Yeah, and I'm fixing your Zesty Chicken Bowl. Will you scoot over?
Okay.
How about a little narration, Mr. Pro Voice Guy?
Oh, right. Grilled all white meat chicken.
You know it. Now for the rice.
Warm seasoned rice.
Not just any cheese, but...
but a delicate blend of three melted cheeses.
Now you're talking. Lettuce.
Crisp lettuce.
And finally, salsa.
Freshly prepared fiesta salsa.
Say it, don't spray it.
Oh, sorry. Taco Bell's Zesty Chicken Bowl. Made right when you order it so it tastes even better. For fresh made taste, think outside the bun.
At participating locations.
Nice.
When it's late and you're hungry, listen to the little voice in your head.
Taco Bell is open late.
Spice up the night. Think outside the bun.
Open till 1 a.m. or later. Hours may vary by location.
This Thursday night at the Emerald Theater in Mount Clemens. Even the odd. Records recording artists Even the Odd performing music from their debut album popular among fan owners. Even the Odd with very special guest Viral Shaw.
also featuring Given Six, this Thursday night at the Emerald Theater, downtown Mount Clemens. Doors open 7 p.m., all ages welcome. Tickets for Even the Odd, Meryl Shaw, and Given Six available now at all Ticketmaster outlets. Charge by phone at 248-645-6666 or online at Ticketmaster.com. This Thursday night, Even the Odd, and special guests Meryl Shaw and Given Six at the Emerald Theater, 31 North Walnut Street, downtown Mount Clemens. Visit eventheodd.net and merylshaw.com.
Do you want a degree that gets the job done? Get it at Wayne State University. 97% of our students get a job within 6 months of graduation in fields as diverse as education, performing arts, pharmacy, social work, and urban affairs. We also have a great honors program in graduate school.
Get it.
Get it by going online at wayne.edu or calling 877-WSU-INFO. Take a virtual tour of one of our state-of-the-smart residence halls with private baths and living arranged by major. Or cruise our campus in person and get yourself a latte in our new campus bookstore or get pumped in our new fitness center.
Come on, get it.
Wayne State University. World-class education in the real world. Get it by going online at wayne.edu or calling 877-WSU-INFO.
Get it.
Get ready for the biggest ATV sale of the century at Anderson's. Anderson's made a special purchase on truckloads of Bombardier Traxxer ATVs, and they are blowing them out the door at unheard-of pricing. Starting Monday, October 20th through Saturday, October 25th, Anderson's will have blowout pricing on all ATVs. Enter to win a new Traxxer ATV or take a demo ride on the ATV of your dreams. Factory reps will be on hand to answer all of your questions. Watch the ATVs as they battle it out in a tug of war. Take a trip into the money machine and have lunch on them. So don't miss the ATV sale of the century at Anderson's, located on Telegraph Road in Bloomfield Hills, or call 248-858-2300 for more information. That's 248-858-2300. $39 per month and 3.9% financing on all Bombardier Traxxer ATVs. See Anderson's for details. Anderson's blowout sale, Monday, October 20th through Saturday, October 25th only. Stop by for huge savings or call Anderson's at 248-858-2300.
Getting engaged or married soon? Finding the ideal ring doesn't have to be hard. Just remember these love letters, JBR. For over 70 years, the experts at J.B. Robinson Jewelers have been helping men like you get the perfect engagement ring. Imagine placing on her hand what you have in your heart. Right now, you'll save 25 to 60% off the regular or ticketed prices on a fantastic selection of engagement rings and wedding rings in yellow gold, white gold, or platinum. So visit JBR and let us help you save precisely how much her love means to you.
When the two of you know it's forever, just remember these love letters.
JB Robinson.
Shop JB Robinson Jewelers, 10 convenient locations. Free financing for 1 year available. Minimum purchase and minimum monthly payments required.
Well, that blue light realizes life is filled with tough choices. Let's say you're hanging out on the dock with a few of your closest friends when you realize you need more cold blue lights from the fridge inside. There's the guy thing to do.
Hey, Doug! Can you bring down some more cold blue lights?
Because Doug isn't a trained monkey. That won't work. You can resort to the very guy thing to do.
Yo, Doug! More blue lights!
That won't work either. That's why you need the blue light thing to do.
Lindsay, if you will.
Oh, Dougie. Doug, can you please bring down some more blue lights?
I'll be right there!
There you go. Doug was on his way before she finished her sentence, making the most of a sweet voice, along with a cold, refreshing Labatt blue light. It's the blue light thing to do. Blue sky, sunlight, blue light. Labatt blue light is imported by Labatt USA, Norwalk, Connecticut. Blue sky and sunlight, imported by nature.
You're listening to Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show with Peter Werby. Our phone number is 313-298-WRIF. If you're on hold trying to get on the show, please stand by. If the lines are busy, please try again.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome back. Talking about a variety of subjects, the Supreme Court's going to hear the case of whether we can have under God in our Pledge of Allegiance to the Flag. Fortunately, the Supreme Court has decided not to take the Bush's appeal that would have jeopardized state medical marijuana laws. So, in other words, those laws are in force so that doctors can help sick people with whatever they think, not what the wacko right-wing John Ashcroft thinks. Also, continuing to talk about Iraq. Hi, this is Night Call. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, hi, this is Brandon. I just recently got back from Iraq. I just wanted to make a shout-out to the person, I don't know, he was a couple callers ago, that was bitching about troops in Iraq back in 1991. Our mission back then wasn't to, you know, find any weapons or weapons of mass destruction. That was to liberate Kuwait because they were, I mean, they were in Kuwait, and that was our mission, was to extract every Iraqi soldier from Kuwait. And I can agree with all the bitching about, you know, President Bush's fucking whatnot on our war. The only problem he made now was he gave Saddam Hussein 8 months in advance the ultimatum to, we're going to invade, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave him till, what was it, February 21st. That was where he made his mistake, because if he did indeed have biological weapons, which everybody in the world knows he did because he's testing them out on his own sons. I mean, he's killed his own sons in his own gas chambers.
Wait. I would say the opposite is true, that now virtually nobody thinks he had weapons of mass destruction. I mean, there's no evidence of them. His own, the guy he sent over there, David Kay, came back. They've been looking for him for 3 or 4 months. They've had 1,200 people doing it, and they've found nothing.
They pulled up three vans full of biological weapons buried underneath the desert.
Well, you got different information than anybody here has. And has never been reported here. Those vans that they found, which they floated this information. You know, rather than arguing about this, I think me and everyone else that's listening would, because if you and I have like an argument about whether there was weapons of mass destruction or not, you could be someone who was never there. What I think we're all interested in is what in the hell is going on over there with you and the unit that you're with.
Well, actually, I cannot exactly say what unit I was with, but we were basically there before anybody else was.
Mm-hmm.
And we were trying to clear paths for our infantry brothers that were coming in behind us. So, therefore, I don't really know exactly how to answer your question on that.
What branch of the service are you?
I'm a Marine. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. And where were you? Can you tell? I mean, I don't want to, you know, give away any secrets, but what can you tell you what part of the country you're in or anything like that?
I was right around Baghdad. That's all I can really say
at
this point.
And I'm just interested in your impressions of it. You know, what it was all like. I mean, you hear everything from, you know, how bad conditions were there for GIs now that they got all these sick and wounded U.S. troops in these hospitals in Fort Stewart that are in terrible, you know, being, you know, not given the proper treatment and everything. What's
right.
going on?
Yeah, on that part, actually, I can agree with you, is with all the soldiers we've been losing lately, it's more of a lost cause than it is more for the effect.
Mm-hmm.
And for the fact that we haven't really uncovered anything, it was kind of a waste of all our soldiers' lives and whatnot. But, I mean, you can't really blame President Bush on the whole thing because he was actually trying to do something. I mean, because nobody would go over there and say, yeah, he has chemical weapons or he doesn't. And, even Bush was in the wrong to say he has chemical weapons that he's going to use on the rest of the world, because you can't prove that somebody's going to use something, because we have nukes ourselves. I mean, anything that they have, we have 10 times worse. And, you know, that's like us contradicting ourselves by saying somebody else can't have them because we still have them. So I can agree with that whole argument, but I can't disagree with why we're over there right now.
What's it like? You know, we hear these reports that are, you know, so heart-wrenching, that two and three of you guys being lost every single day. I mean, what's that like? I mean, it almost always seems by ambush, right?
Well, our entire military pretty much is over there right now.
Mm-hmm.
So, granted, it is two or three a day, and you live with that in the back of your mind. But, I mean, it's not like two or three people you know are dying every day. But more of them that are setting the ambushes or killing our troops are dying per day also. So, I mean, they're the ones carrying on the war, even though it's supposed to be a closed war right now. But, I mean, it's still going on their own streets.
What's the maximum? So you're going back soon, are you?
Hopefully not, no.
Oh.
But I could be.
Oh, okay. I thought people were just getting a little bit. Are you like on medical leave or something?
No, I'm not on on medical leave, but my tour is running up, and that law that Bush passed about people not being able to leave the military when their tour ran up, I'm hoping that I get excluded from that, because this is my fifth year now. And
wow. Would you, when this enlistment's over, will you plan to go back again?
No, I'm going to school, actually.
Yeah. Well, good. Well, best of luck to you, and I hope you stay safe and as well as everyone else. Good talking to you. Bye-bye.
Yeah.
Wow. You know, so much of this is facts and figures. There's something about the listing in the New York Times where they have a list of, I've never seen, is this in other papers, that they have a list of the American dead in almost at Vietnam, in Iraq. And it's so strange. It'll be, you know, 19-year-old, 22-year-old, then it'll be a 46-year-old. All right, your thoughts. I was going to tell you a couple things. Oh, yeah, some entertainment things that are going on. The MC5, all of you know about that? MC5 was a band from the 60s that they always say is seminal. You know, like an early beginning band that started it all. Like seminal, you know, something else, word similar to that. Anyways, a movie about them is called MC5, A True Testimonial. It's going to be held Thursday, October 30th at 7:30 p.m. in the Art Institute. You can call the Art Institute for tickets, and I hear they're going you can only do this through October 17th. I guess you got to go down to the box office now at the Detroit Institute of Arts. Also, Steve Earle. And I'm surprised how few people, I said, yeah, Steve Earle's coming to town. And so many people didn't know who they are. Rick Fox, you know who Steve Earle is? Ah, damn. I thought he was I know he did the soundtrack. He did the music for Dead Man Walking, you know, that thing with Sean Penn. So he does kind of roots rock stuff. And he's coming to St. Andrews on Wednesday, the 22nd. Just coming right up. I'm going to be out of town or I'd miss him. Although he and a number of other people are being sponsored in a tour that's called Tell Us the Truth. And you go to tellusthetruth.org. And so it includes, and I found out other people don't know who these people are. Billy Bragg, who is an English kind of rocker and folk singer, really. Lester Chambers from the Chambers Brothers. Rick Fox, you know who the Chambers Brothers were? You know that old song, that old classic rock song, Time? Time has come today. Time! You're kind of a psychedelic song. Well, this was the lead singer. And this Tell Us the Truth tour is going to come here on November 11th here in Detroit. And then it's also going to be in Miami on November the 19th. And I'm going to be down there because there's going to be these demonstrations against this ministerial meeting of these people that are trying to put together the free trade area of the Americas. Now, if you think NAFTA hurt us, wiped out good portions of the industrial base of the United States and Canada, wait till you see the FTAA, the Free Trade Area of the Americas. It's NAFTA on steroids. So the AFL-CIO, and lots of other groups, are calling for demonstrations. And there's going to be a number of concerts. And let's see, I thought there was going to be a third person. Annie DeFranco, you've heard of her, I know that, right? Annie DeFranco. So you can go to tellusthetruth.org, or you can go to my website, peterwerbe.com, PETERWERBE.com. And if you go to some sites and then go to home, you'll get my new site. It's not really completed, but what the hell, you can figure that out. All right, continuing onward. Hi, WRIF, you're on the air. Good evening. Hey.
Yeah, Peter, how you doing?
Doing good.
Yeah, I just want to tell you, first time I ever heard the show is coming back from up north, and I absolutely love it. I love what you're doing. I love getting everybody's opinions out there.
Well, that's what we're here for. Thank you for joining us.
Something wonderful. Also, I'd like to thank the gentleman that was on before me, the Marine. I never joined the service myself. To me, I fight for my fellow man, but my country, they really don't do much for us with all the backstabbing and screwing around they're doing. I'd like to personally thank him and all the other troops over there for putting their life on the line for guys like me.
Sure.
So no disrespect to them, but our government, to me, is not doing a whole lot of good for us.
Yeah, you know, there's actually a guy across the street has a sign that says, support our troops, bring them home.
Uh-huh.
There you go.
See, somebody, it's great. Bring them home alive. And
sure.
I mean, like our government, I don't even know where to start. There's so many things to touch on, like Mr. Bush starting World War III. And to me, I don't think he ever really had a right to. We went over there looking for terrorists, and he kind of got everybody looking over in that direction, and all of a sudden, oh, well, Iraq's a threat all of a sudden. It was never really about that, but once he diverted us, hey, there's a new target.
There you go. Yeah.
Kind of threw us all off. Another thing, I'm definitely going to spread the word about your show and try and get as many people as I can. I'm a younger guy. I'm only 24, and I absolutely love it. But I think the problem is a lot of our people, a lot of the American citizens, they turn it on CNN, MSNBC, and all of a sudden they're a political analyst or a military analyst, and they think they know what's going on.
I know. There's so many other historical events. At the moment, everybody just kind of repeats, just like if you lived in the Soviet Union or something, you repeat the party line. And then like a year later, or 5 years later, or 30 years later, the truth about some historical incident, which by then is history, comes out, and people go, oh, yeah, well, whatever. But right now, it's so important to find out all of what's going on and not just a little piece of it. Hey, thank you for joining us.
Oh, most definitely. One more thing.
Sure.
Before we start looking at everybody else's problems, look at our government itself. We got the Republicans, the Democrats, left-wing, right-wing, and people riding on the tail. If our governments can't get along, look at all the bickering and the slander and all the nonsense that goes on. And, yeah, we're supposed to be setting a mark for everybody to follow. Our own government can't get along, and yet we got the Terminator running for office, winning as a joke with porn stars right next to him. I mean, that's definitely not showing the world that we really know what's going on. Look at down in Florida. Yeah, we know exactly how to work things. I don't know. One big joke after another, but I'm going to save you some time, get on to the next call. I really appreciate what you're doing.
Well, I really appreciate you calling in, and thank you for telling people, and join us again. Thank you so much.
Most definitely. Have a good one.
Bye-bye now. Let's see here. Davis wrote in to nightcall@wrif.com. He says, Peter, I'm afraid the right-wingers have won. That's what he says. He says, I'm sad to say that I don't share your optimism. I'm talking about the, Bush is out of here. I was trying to make a bet with Meltdown that Bush was going to leave office before January 20th, 2005. There's a countdown counter on my website. You can see that. That's for January 20th, 2005. Now, Davis says, I see no way in hell that Dumbia Bush will lose in 2004. Karl Rove and Bush have a political money machine like no other in history. All Bush has to do is drag out the magic words Al-Qaeda, and his popularity goes up. I don't know, Davis. It's going down. It's a big article about how he's losing one of his big bases, seniors, because they're getting screwed so badly. Davis says people are either willfully ignorant or uneducated in political matters. Very few really consider the things that you talk about. I fear it will be Dumbia in 2004 and Jeb in 2008. The Democratic Party is a ship without a rudder. The wacko right wing controls most of the media and 99% of talk radio. We are toast, says Davis. What do you think? 313-298-WRIF or nightcall@wrif.com. Hi, this is Night Call. You're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, Peter. I've heard you bring up the comparison of the Corleone family to the Bush family, but unfortunately, we wind up with Fredo.
Right? We have Fredo in office, right.
Hey, Mike, I'm smart. Anyway, that kind of leads into what I really wanted to talk about. And The Godfather, too, most of it was set in Cuba. And my point is, if we're so into liberating countries, why don't we liberate Cuba? I mean, this is a country in our own backyard. Most of the citizens would be quite favorable to democracy since they're not really big fans of Castro there. And I've actually heard Colin Powell say in the past when asked this question that, well, it's only a matter of time before that regime is toppled, which is exactly what Dean Rusk said. You know who's Secretary of State Dean Rusk was?
Well, it was Johnson's.
For, right?
Johnson's.
For Kennedy.
Oh, Kennedy. So it was 40 years ago, yeah.
Any day, this regime will be toppled 40 years ago.
Well, you have to remember that the existence, Castro's existence for the United States, and the United States' existence for Castro, serves a mutually beneficial purpose. Each of them can point to the other to say, look how awful the other is. And there's elements of truth in what both governments say about the other.
Yeah, but, I mean, Cuba and communism is not the threat anymore. It hasn't been for a long time. And, what it comes down to is there's not a lot of oil in Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
And we could basically turn it into a giant Las Vegas if we wanted to, and lots of corporations in this country would make billions and billions of dollars. So,
but that's the way it started. You have to remember the reason that there's Castro is because of the United States' support for the most horrible some of the most horrible dictatorships in Latin America that the United States supported in Cuba, and ending with Batista. I mean, that's why, in fact, it's failed foreign policy in so many areas of the world, including Iran, that has led to the establishment of governments hostile to the United States. And the reason they're hostile is that previously the United States supported some awful police state, torture state. Now, they're not going to invade Cuba because they can kind of have their cake and eat it, too. I mean, eventually this is going to crumble. And they can keep, pulling the chain of these right-wing Cubans in Florida and Miami to get the votes they need for the Republicans. And the idea of invading it, I mean, all the people I've known that have gone to Cuba, on one hand, the government is not thought of in high regard, but they're very nationalistic. And there are large sections of the population that support the government, and they also have a very, very intact army. And unless you're going to just, nuke the island or something like that, it wouldn't be easy. So there's no intention of Bush to invade Cuba. Well, those could be lame as fast words, I realize.
Yeah, but my point being is that when they give us the excuse that we're liberating the Iraqis, we couldn't give a rat's ass about the Iraqis or really anybody. They don't even give a rat's ass about most Americans, much less Iraqis. That's my point.
Sure.
Is that
hey,
we're going to liberating someone. Let's liberate someone 90 miles away. It's a lot easier. It'll be a lot cheaper too.
You want to read something extraordinarily interesting about Cuba? What's his name? Bush was just on television. He was pimping to these Miami Cubans. And he was talking about how there's all this sex trade going on in Cuba, sex tourism. Well, I mean, it's really big in Eastern Europe, all the U.S. allies and what have you. But someone I know has been to Cuba numerous times and wrote a very, very interesting piece that you can link onto on my website. Do you have a computer?
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you get, how to spell my last name?
Yeah, Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, right?
Yeah, so you just go to peterwerbe.com. It's the first, just click on the photograph there, and it's a pretty interesting story. Okay?
Okay, all right.
Thank you. Yeah, no, Bush is not interested in liberating anything, because all these alliances that he's made with these South Asian dictatorial regimes, first biggest one, Pakistan. Now, Dave writes in to nightcall@wrf.com, Bolivia. We were talking about that. He said there were riots to stop the operation of natural gas. Were they exporting to us? Well, that was no. They were going to take this natural gas from Bolivia. It was going to go through Chile, and then it was going to go to these big U.S. and international corporations. I think of all the gas lines that come across one day of HVAC service. What is HVAC service? I'm going to have to read this one over. All right. Let's do this. Let's take a break, and we'll be right back to get your calls. Hey, by the way, there's also a new David Rovics album. You fans of David Rovic, R-O-V-I-C-S. You can go to davidrovics.com or access it through my website. In exactly 1 hour, I'm going to play a song I love called After the Revolution. Many of you say, gee, what would the world be like after you had your ideals put into practice, Pete? Well, David Rovics has the nicest and kind of even humorful, humorous, I guess is the word, right? Humorous little take on it. So we'll get that on in an hour on the show. All right, hold on.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werbe on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Peter will be back to take more calls right after this.
So, you're at the bar with your
boyfriend,
girlfriend,
enjoying a great-tasting Miller Lite. As the waitress brings you another round, you wonder,
when is he gonna propose?
Where the heck are my chicken strips?
Because
we've been dating for years.
The cheese sticks didn't fill me up.
Then, a film crew taking auditions for a Miller Lite commercial passes your table, which immediately shifts your thoughts away from...
the idiot I'm dating.
Deep-fried poultry.
To thoughts of fame and fortune. So, you mug for the camera with Miller Lite in tow and bust out your A material concerning...
males and their aversion to commitment.
The lack of service in this joint.
This impromptu outburst sends a ripple of satisfaction surging through your person, motivating you to...
grab another Miller Lite.
Grab another Miller Lite.
Before you head back to your table, where you'll...
kick him to the curb.
Pray for both barbecue sauce and honey mustard.
Miller Lite is taking auditions at a bar near you. Grab a Miller Lite. Be on TV. Certain restrictions apply. Live responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Look again. Look again. Ford trucks, your old American friend.
Introducing the one and only truck which has earned the right to be the next F-150. It has an all-new front suspension, larger, more powerful four-wheel disc brakes with ABS, best-in-class interior, and is the safest F-150 ever due to a personal safety system. Now you can lease this powerful 2004 F-150 XLT 4x2 for $329 a month for returning AZD plan lessees and eligible family members. Lease it now for only $329 a month for 36 months through Ford credit with $1,456 due at signing, excluding title and taxes. This payment includes $1,000 renewal bonus if you currently lease a Ford Division product and lease a new one and take retail delivery from dealer stock by 12-103. Some payments higher, some lower. Not all lessees will qualify. Residency restrictions apply.
See your Metro Detroit Ford dealer today and think Ford first.
Welcome to Werewolf Canyon at Cedar Point's Hollow Weekends. I'll be your guide. Now, it's a very narrow canyon and the fog is dense, so watch your step. No! Oh no! Stay back! Never underestimate the appetite of these mutated beasts. And whatever you do, don't lose me. I know the way out. I can help you. These creatures are almost human.
Monster Fun is back at the world's best amusement park. And this year, it's bigger and better than ever. Dare to enter new Werewolf Canyon, an extended fright zone, and three haunted houses. Plus, ride your favorite monster coasters like Top Thrill Dragster and Millennium Force.
Okay, all right. We're almost to the exit. And please, you go first, and I'll just wait.
It's your last chance to scream in the park every Friday night, Saturday, and Sunday through October 26th. Halloween weekends at Cedar Point. Monster Fun.
For monster savings on Halloween tickets, look for specially marked cans of Diet Pepsi. Save $12 on Sunday and $10 on Saturdays.
Hi. Thanks for calling Comcast High Speed Internet. Are you calling about our special offer?
Hello. Yes. This is John Smith.
Okay. Mr. Smith, how did you hear about us?
My hard drive. My grandmother told me about your service. Nana told me it's up to 25 times faster than dial-up, and always on. I want to be that fast. Oops. My computer wants to be that fast.
Are you sure you're not a computer?
What? That is crazy talk, sir. How could, there goes my stomach. I have to go now. I'm disconnecting. I have hockey practice.
Computers will do anything to get Comcast high-speed internet. Sign up now and get 6 months for just $19.99 a month. Call 1-888-COMCAST. Offer ends November 30th. Restrictions apply. Download speed compared to 56K dial-up. Installation fees apply. Call for pricing and service details.
Hello, this is Lawrence Ellison from Biltmore Properties.
And I'm David Hall from Rock Financial.
Renters, are you ready to move up to owning a new home? Biltmore has homes starting as low as $159,000. A complete home set in our communities that evoke the charm of small-town America, Cherry Hill Village in Canton, and Forester Square in Auburn Hills. A home that you'll own starting at just $159,000.
And Lauren, with Rock Financial's new Smart Choice Interest Only Loan, on $159,000 mortgage payments on that new home, get this, less than $600 a month.
For more information, look for our Sunday newspaper ad. Visit us on the web at biltmore-homes.com. That's biltmore-homes.com. Or call us at 248-641-3900.
Biltmore, town builder since 1924. Rate is variable and subject to change. Based on 10% down, the interest-only payment is for 3 years with a rate of 3.875%. APR 4.088%. After 3 years, principal and interest payments can adjust to $757, which includes PMI, and will adjust every 6 months after that. Rock Financial is a Quicken Loans company. Equal housing
mortgage lender.
You're listening to Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show with Peter Werby. Our phone number is 313-298-WRIF. If you're on hold trying to get on the show, please stand by. If the lines are busy, please try again.
Thank you very much. WRIF Detroit, that's our official designation. Now we are legal with the Federal Communications Commission. And greetings to all of you around the country and around the world listening to this on WRIF.com. I was kind of stumbling over what someone had written in an email, and Stephen wrote in, you know, I'm not having good luck switching people to our new email. You can call. You can do either one. Call talkyes@yahoo.com or nightcall@wrif.com. Some ways it's easier to do the call talk yes, but anyway. Anyway, Stephen writes in regards to an email you read not long ago. People on the net refer to George W. Bush as W, D-U-B-Y-A. It's pronounced W. Hope this helps. Well, they're saying it. You know, first thing you learn when you go to broadcast school is you don't say W. Like you don't say W, I can't even say it, W-R-I-F. You say W. So it's like double U. I used to work years ago for what was called W4 when it was a rock station. You didn't know it was a rock station? Yeah, yeah, it was a rock. I mean, everybody used to, Doug Podell, Steve Costan, I mean, everybody from all the rockers around. Anyway, so the official call letters were WWWW, right? Not WWWW. Anyways, so, no, it's not pronounced W, or maybe it is, Stephen, if you say it. Depends. Anyways, I know it's W. D-U-B-Y-A. I'm kind of making fun of him. But what the email writer had, he had it as Dumya. D-U-M-B-Y-A. That's why I was stumbling over it. But thank you. Hey, if you're into reading, what a concept, huh? People are still doing it. And all these left-wing books are doing great guns. Number one, Dude, Where's My Country? Michael Moore. Yeah, you go to michaelmoore.com, M-O-O-R-E, michaelmoore.com. He's got a great site. Sometimes he gets, what, a million hits a month. Dude, Where's My Country, number one. Number two is a right-wing book, Bill O'Reilly. I'll get back to that. Number three, Al Franken's Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them, and a bunch of other stuff. Then number six, Bushwhacked by Molly Ivins, I-V-I-N-S. Molly Ivins, very cool. Madam Secretary, this is Madeleine Albright, who was Secretary of State and Ambassador of the United Nations under Clinton. Number eight, The Great Unraveling by Paul Krugman, New York Times columnist who talks about the destruction that the Bush Co., you know, make it, that's what Jim Hightower calls the Bush government, Bush Co. You know, the Bush essentially just has turned our government into a 100% corporate racket. Number nine, the pill-popping dope addict's brother, David Limbaugh, has written a book, Persecution. Now, this is where we get to the interesting part of it. He argues that liberals are waging war against Christianity. But this has got to be, you know, like the, yeah, I don't get it either, Rick Fox. You know, what's up with that? Last time I looked, every town you go into has got, you know, more churches than whatever, right? So I don't think Christianity's in any bad point. But they have a dagger after it. Were we talking about this? And what happens is these right-wing groups and these right-wing companies, or these companies owned by right-wing CEOs, they'll go buy 1,000 of these books at a crack, or sometimes even more, because they want to drive up the appearance of its popularity. Laura Ingraham, right-wing wacko, right-wing commentator, Shut Up and Sing, that she's attacking what she calls the elites of Hollywood. So in other words, if you're a singer, like all of our rock stars, all of our movie stars, all these theater people that exercise their constitutional right to speak out, she's telling them to shut up and sing. See, these are fascists. You know, I was telling you earlier about that lawn sign that my neighbor had that says, actually it says, peace, support our troops, bring them home. Twice, people have driven up on his lawn and torn it down. These are people that say they believe in democracy, the Constitution, and private property. And they violate all three. Because most of these people are what I would call proto-fascists. P-R-O-T-O hyphen fascists. They're not really fascists yet, but this is the tendency. And what they want is all of us to just shut up. It's not about sing. Most of us, they want us to shut up and work. They don't want us to challenge authority. They don't want us to question authority. They don't want us to question anybody in power unless it happens to be somebody like Bill Clinton. Then they love it. Down the line, though, number 19, still, Stupid White Men by Michael Moore. That book was the best-selling hardcover of 2002. And 21, that's a right-winger, I think. I want to talk about it. Number 29, The Lies of George W. Bush by David Korn, which is an excellent book, by the way. David Korn is the Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine. You can go to thenation.com. It's about a 150-year-old publication. Number 35, Big Lies by Joe Connison, C-O-N-A-S-O-N. You go to my website, and I think there's a link that says books that will drive your conservative friends crazy because they tell the truth. And conservatives are in this polemic against reality. So they need these whacked-out books that that they feverishly buy or they're given to by the corporation that's purchased them for them so they can figure out, how can I still be a racist? And how can I be war and how pro-war? And how can I still support these people that are ripping me off? And how can I support people that don't support the right of workers or a decent wage in this country? Oh, here it is. Here's the information in this book. Remember, too, that I always say about these right-wingers. You and I, we can look at our lives. We can look at our communities. We can look at our families. We can look at our jobs, and we think there's a lot of things wrong. We want to correct those. You talk to these right-wingers, there's only one thing wrong in the world, liberals. If it wasn't for liberals, that everything would be perfect. What they mean is the way, and this gets back to shut up and sing, what they mean is that any kind of fascistic dictatorship, whether it's Stalin or Hitler or whoever, you got to remember, these dictators had a lot of popular support because people love authority. A third of the population, those are the third that can be fooled all the time in Lincoln's dictum. So they hate dissenters. They hate anybody that's going to disturb the order of power. Even it can screw them so badly, they're just out there pumping for these people that are ripping them off, sending their sons and daughters off to be killed. This is, the working poor, the working class. It's almost about 90% of who joins. And they just said, yes, sir, let me salute the flag, under God. I mean, it's really pathetic. 313-298-WRIF, line one. Mr. Fox, thank you. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, Peter, that's a great list. It's fascinating. Begs the question, why don't Michael Moore and Al Franken have talk shows? They're selling more books than these right-wing clowns.
Why do you think?
Because it's censorship, pure censorship.
Sure.
They don't want to hear them.
Can I tell you something which you may know?
What's that?
That I didn't ever say. But did you know that for 2.5 years, I had a national talk show at the same time I was doing this show?
Yeah, but I missed it.
Well, I know because
you got
it never went into
quit.
I didn't know.
Fired,
no.
I mean.
Yeah, well, I mean, I got essentially terminated. I like that better. And the reason, one of the reasons I got terminated is that essentially station managers would not pick up the show because they would say they want a liberal talk show host, and then they'd hear me and they go, wait a minute, this guy doesn't sound like Tom Daschle or Joe Lieberman. He is too far out. So these stations actually that I did have, they did the best. They did the best that they ever had done. And there's more things could be happening in the future. But it was pure political censorship. They usually say liberal shows are boring. Well, no one ever said we don't want Peter Werby's show because it's boring. Every single station manager, program director said he's too far out. He's a crazy leftist. He's a professional Bush hater. Well, of course I'm a professional Bush hater. I get paid.
That's sad because I'm the opposite. I look forward to your show every week. To me, it's an island of sanity in a sea of right-wing propaganda, nonsense, insanity.
Yeah.
What I wanted to say is about Cuba. Do you remember just right after he started talking about Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction, Jimmy Carter plans a trip to Cuba.
Right.
And then Bush and company start saying, Cuba, he's got weapons of mass destruction. He's got chemical weapons.
Right.
He's terrible. Carter goes, I'll check it out. And if you listen to him carefully, he said he called a friend of his in the State Department and said, okay, where should I go? What should I look for? you know, taking Bush's charge seriously, right?
Mm-hmm.
And his friend said, there's nothing to look for. He's got nothing. So the media just dropped it. Why didn't they pursue this? This was probably the most important question facing the country and the world. Evidence that it's still one of the biggest questions facing the world. Was Bush wrong? Was he lying? Or was Carter wrong? The media just dropped it.
Well, this
is
imagine. Well, this is the kind of thing. This was an Undersecretary of State, John Bolton, who fabricated this lie, and in a large extent, it was done to undercut Carter's trip to Cuba. And Bolton essentially created this lie that could have been the basis for an attack on Cuba, and then it's just been dropped. But think about how many things that Bush said that have been dropped. About remember, I've said this a few times about these ships that were circling the globe with Iraqi chemical weapons that could be launched against the United States. And Bush continues any number of lies when he talks about Iraq, about that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. Well, he did have weapons of mass destruction, but that's kind of an ambiguous phrase because it doesn't mean he had them when the United States invaded the last time. It means he had them the first time, and his dad didn't show any propensity to overthrow him.
But for the media to drop that is just totally unforgivable, because imagine for a second if Clinton had said something like that and he was wrong. They would never would have let it rest, never. You'd hear about it endlessly. Instead, here's this important question. We have to get to, because if, say, Bush was lying or was wrong about this in Cuba, maybe, just maybe he's wrong and about it in Iraq and we don't need to go to war. Instead, the press just completely drops it, sweeps it under the carpet, and we don't know.
Well, that's typical, but you know, you have this, you're saying we, and I don't know. I mean, I knew this. It wasn't, I always say to people, you know, every once in a while I run into people on the street and they say, boy, you're so smart. And I go, huh? Because all I do is read. It's not like I'm smart. I never graduated college. I probably have average intelligence.
You have to be able to think for yourself in this country, because if you don't, you're not going to know anything.
Well, I know, but the point being is all this information is knowable. Like I knew, I mean, as soon as Bush invented this, concocted this story down in Crawford, Texas, that Saddam Hussein represented a threat to the United States and to the Middle East because of weapons of mass destruction, I said, what? And I mean, it took me about 40 minutes of reading to understand that Bush had just fabricated this lie in order to take the heat off him for Enron and, 100 other things that were driving his popularity down. So in other words, what I'm saying is I didn't need a whole lot of brain power to figure this out.
Right. Michael Moore's movie is called Canadian Bacon. His movie Bowling for Columbine is a great movie. Everyone should see it. But this movie Canadian Bacon, he comes out and the presidential character is advised, you have to start a war. Start a war against Canada. And the guy goes, the people won't buy that. And one advisor said, the people will believe anything you tell them. They will fall for anything you tell them. It's that simple. And it's so true. Look what happened with Iraq.
I wonder why Michael Moore's film, Canadian Bacon, never really made it. I've never seen it.
It's like a preview of the Bush administration, pretty much.
Yeah, yeah.
You have to see, it's real funny. It's very intelligent and very informative.
I'm going to get it. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. And here's our next caller. Welcome to the broadcast. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I remember reading in Stupid White Men that he claimed that some 80% of Bush's money for his 2000 campaign was donated by 500 or less people. That I found that extremely disturbing, that it's clearly not we the people. He expects, when these few people contribute that much money to a campaign, they want some money back. They want some favors.
You don't think they're interested? You don't think the pharmaceutical industry and the banking industry and the telecommunications industry is interested in good government? You actually think they want something back that will pay them back for their investment? How cynical, sir!
Well, I think that my question is I follow that argument that Bush is in Iraq for his oil buddies. I can follow that, but when my conservative friends challenge me and they say, "Well, how exactly do domestic oil interests benefit from us being there?" I mean, how specifically do they go over there and they take their oil from them, or is it through price controls? But how how is it that our oil interests here, his oil buddies, benefit from us being there? Exactly. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's for one thing, it's not it's long range, and we've reached or almost have reached peak production worldwide. That means that we've used up about 50% of the oil, the known oil reserves in the world. And this is going to become a scarcer and scarcer commodity as the decades go on. And the United States, under people like George Bush and Dick Cheney, that are tied into the, sort of the old, the 20th century, if you will, and those forms of energy, want to ensure that the source, really the source of profit, but also the source of generating fuel, remains in the hands of the United States. And you think, well, hell, that's not a bad deal. You know, we want to have a strategic control of what we need to continue on as the nation as we have. Well, the only thing is, then we get involved in wars in Iraq, and probably is not even going to work. So have ExxonMobil and companies like that benefited directly from the war in Iraq? Well, I mean, to some extent, but not greatly. They're already making, I mean, ExxonMobil has had some of its best quarters in a long time because of these jacked up gasoline prices that they've been charging. But eventually, and what the vision of these neoconservatives were, and you can go back to these papers, what is it, Project for a New American Century, back 5 years or so, even when before Bush and his gang were in power, is they talk about the necessity for control. And essentially, they don't use the word empire, but essentially what they want is to control through both wealth and direct military intervention, the oil reserves of the world. They worried about Saudi Arabia because it's a very brittle regime. Because it's this, why don't we liberate the Saudi people from this terrible religious dictatorship? Well, they're our buddies. But we don't know what's going to happen there. And the United States wants to have direct presence in terms of, a friendly government, B, a military presence. Will oil companies associated with the United States get concessions there? I'm sure. I mean, that's going to happen. But also, what Bush has done to the economy and how fragile world capitalism always is in terms of sending certain regions into penury, into poverty. I mean, great sections of the world already live in extreme poverty, even though they don't have to. It's because of this maldistribution of wealth. Well, some people think that Saddam Hussein sealed his fate when he announced that he was going to begin trading oil in euros rather than dollars. And right now, the American dollar is the international currency for all practical purposes. And the idea that one of the major commodities of the world would begin to be traded in euros because there is, Europe's our buddy, right? Well, under, capitalist system, there's no such thing as buddies. I mean, once in a while, you have strategic alliances, but ultimately, everybody's a competitor. So there's lots of issues, people will say it's all for oil, or it's all to secure the dollar, or it's all because Bush is crazy, or any number of things. But it's really a confluence of a lot of different things. But in terms of oil, it both has to do with control of the huge resources under Iraq, and also to have a direct presence in the region to be able to control it.
Okay. Go ahead. One other comment was, I remember reading something to the effect of how we always pushing to drill for oil in Alaska, and the statistic that disturbed me there was the entire amount of oil in Alaska that's thought to be underground by the geologists, that whole amount is less than what would be saved if you just increase the miles per gallon on your vehicles 1.5 miles per gallon for 1 year.
Sure. Well, there is something of these neocons. I mean, they have this fascist mentality. I mean, I'm sorry to say that. It may sound rude, and just like I'm making an ad hominem attack, an attack on the person rather than their views. But there is this urge to destroy. And it is the psychopathology that they're gleeful about destroying what environmentalists would like to preserve. And, well, you know, actually, where I thought I had this as a message here somewhere that someone wrote, if I can find it quickly. I think these neocons are the sickest people on the face of the earth, writes Tony. All right, thank you very much.
All right, thanks.
Appreciate your call. That's the end of it. He says, he wrote into nightcall at WRIF.com, I just started listening to your show. Very nice. I like to say the one thing that really pisses me off is when Clinton was president, the Republicans didn't want to give him a lick of credit. They stated the economy was the business cycle, and it was the Republican budgets and Alan Greenspan that turned the country around. Says some other thing. Now W has the country in a mess. All of a sudden, it's Clinton's fault. The neocons blame Clinton for everything. It was his recession. He's responsible for the September 11th attack, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, they're not big on taking responsibility either. And our next caller, thank you very much, Rick Fox. Be sure to listen to Rick. He'll be on the air at 2 a.m. Hi, this is WRIF, Peter Werby, and you're on the air. Go ahead.
How are you doing, Peter? Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I wanted to, this is kind of swaying off of what you were just talking about, but I wanted to kind of state, I didn't share your optimism in saying that Bush is not going to get reelected. When you look at the budget that incoming candidates have compared to his, it's almost going to be impossible for them to get in when they're working like, I think that, last time I checked, I think either Clark or Dean, they were like the top running candidates, and their budget was almost like not even half of what Bush's is.
Half? No, it's like 10%.
I think it's like $34 million.
Who? Which one?
Bush.
He's
no.
Bush has like, $84 million he's already raised.
Oh, Jesus.
And he has no primary opposition, so all these other candidates have to use their money up for that. Well, that goes back. Actually, Irene from Detroit wrote me, and she's, you know, I'm always saying Lincoln's dictum, you can fool some of the people all the time, and all some of the, you can fool all the people some of the time, some of the people all the time, but not all the people all the time. And I always say that there's a third of the people that you can fool all the time. Those are the hardcore ideological conservatives, and they get fooled because they want to be fooled. They love power. They don't have the guts to challenge anybody in authority. And so Irene says in this letter that she wrote, actually wrote a letter to me. I should have brought it and read part of it. She says that I'm dreaming that the percentage of people that can be fooled all the time is much, much greater. I guess I do have an optimism that no matter how much money you get, that these people are operating in a manner that is so detrimental to the vast majority of people in this country, to the country itself. And these guys aren't even in many ways acting in their own self-interest. It's just greed and they're a pack of psychos. But the middle class is being harmed. The working class is being harmed. And, yeah, some people are going to be driven around, along by the resentment and their anger and stuff like that. But, you know, I mean, are people going to keep just buying this crap as things get worse and worse? I don't know. I don't think so.
It seems like nothing's really changing. Like, if it's all in our face, you know, everything, all this stuff is in our face. You can't deny all the mistakes that Bush has had. You can't deny that he's an illegitimate leader, that 500,000 more Americans wanted Gore. I mean, whether Gore would have handled it differently, like, doesn't matter now. But the point is, like, we didn't want him as a majority. We didn't want Bush, but he got it. And what makes you think that if all that stuff went down in Florida where there was all those ballots missing and all that, what makes you think that Florida was the only state where there was mistakes? You don't think that New Hampshire or other states that Bush won, you don't think that those possibly had some ballots misplaced or like the ballots were like
I forgot.
In his favor?
Maybe somebody can call. I don't want to give any figures off the top of my head, but there were tons of people, mostly minorities, that were prevented from voting not only in Florida, as we found out. In fact, if there hadn't been this purposeful, what would you call it, something better than a ploy, plot, I guess, to not allow African-Americans to vote in Florida, we wouldn't be having this conversation because Al Gore would be in the White House. But there's also the problem of these touchscreen voting machines. These companies that are putting in these new touchscreen voting machines that leave no paper trail or anything like that, they're all of them are owned lock, stock, and barrel by hardcore Republicans. So, You know, I'm not saying it's all going to be handled at the ballot box. In Bolivia, where there's this amazing victory against the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and United States corporate interests that were looting Bolivia, and they just overthrew the president. And, you know, although the troops were shooting down people, the troops shot down 84 people. Essentially, it was a nonviolent revolution where people all came to the Capitol and said, no. Now, I don't know if you heard me earlier. My wife and I and a number of other friends, we're going to go to Washington.
Yeah, I'll be there.
Oh, you're going to go? Great.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, how many people do you think are going to be there?
How many people do I think
are going to be in Washington this Saturday to protest the Bush war and occupation?
I have no... I don't have an accurate guesstimate at all.
Well, when I went to New York, when she and I went to New York in February 15th, there was about 1 million people in New York. Now, that's good. That's decent. I wouldn't be surprised if there's like 50,000 people in Washington. I mean, you know, that's not a squirt, but, I mean, why isn't there 10 million of us showing up in Washington? And as long as there's not that kind of popular opposition, well, we probably will get jerked around at the ballot box. The elites will control things by the amount of wealth that they command, and they can buy off everything under the sun, including the media.
You can buy everything.
So is it hopeless?
I don't know. I believe I'm with you, man. I am scared to death if Bush gets reelected, because that's 4 more years of this creating terror.
Yeah,
and you know, I don't think that it's as bad as it. It didn't have to be this bad. Like, there didn't have to be this many lives lost. We don't need 19-year-old kids out in front of museums in Iraq getting picked off by snipers, like right. happened to one of my friends from my hometown. He was 19 years old, guarding a museum.
Really?
Guarding a museum, man. Guarding wow. a museum. Picked off from 300 yards away by a sniper, dead. For why? You know, I don't know. He got hit. Family got a flag and got a real nice letter saying, thank you, your son served his country well. And Bush is getting really rich, so be happy.
Yeah, and Bush scammed out of the draft in Vietnam. Cheney scammed out of the draft in Vietnam. Rush Limbaugh scammed out of the draft in Vietnam.
I was on your website, Reed, all about how Bush paid his way through the military, just like almost like making a resume his entire life so he could one day be president, so his daddy, you know, former head of the CIA, could throw him in there. Like, I read on your website how he, like, transferred from base to base, and then you go back and talk to people, and he never even registered there. He never did any time there.
Yeah.
He just had paperwork saying that he did there so he could look like he was a military person, so he could look like he had some kind of pride and liberty. You know, that's his favorite word. That's his favorite word. Every single speech the guy gives is pride, liberty, justice for all. That guy doesn't have an ounce of any of that in his blood. All he's got is greed and money. Look in his eyes, they're green with dollar bills. It's disgusting.
All right, I'll see you in Washington.
Thanks, Pete.
All right, thanks for joining us at 313-298-WRIF. What we're talking about is this mass march that's going to occur. I mean, if you're listening to my voice, you've never been to one of these demonstrations. They're absolutely incredible, the kind of sense of exuberation. I've been to tons of them all my life, and I'm just looking forward to this Saturday like, you know, a kid at Christmas. I mean, walking down the street with 50,000, 100,000 people, a million people sometimes will come out to say no to war, you know, something like that. It's extraordinarily heartening. You can go to UnitedForPeace.org. UnitedForPeace.org. You can go to my website, Peter Werbe, PeterWerbe.com, and link onto it for there, from there. Let's see. Sal in Wyandotte writes in to nightcall@WRIF.com. Further to the point of the person calling to look for elaboration on how to battle the conservatives, my thoughts have centered around the statement that, quote, they keep making, saying that the $87 billion is a loan to us. My take is the U.S. government will act as a general contractor to the greatest construction project since post-World War II Japan, and every one of those 500 or more tight-knit friends will be the benefactors of the new and improved deal-type program to stimulate the economy. Gee, now that's it's out. We peons can wait for the trickle-down and conversion into miserable-paying jobs. Great show. I've been listening for almost 15 years. We've been doing it that long, Sal? I guess so. But you understand what he's saying? This is, to some extent, there's this guy, Keynes. How do you spell it? K-E-Y. I can never spell without a pencil. K-E-Y-N-E-S. And Keynesian economics says that free market capitalism doesn't work. You know, all of these people talk about the free market. I mean, it's just total load of crap. Not a one of them believes it. They believe in the the assistance by government of billions of dollars in all sorts of corporate welfare. And essentially, well, this is what's going on. We were saying earlier, let me see, this is on my site too. What are the figures here? It says, cost to U.S. taxpayers to destroy Iraq, $60 billion. To rebuild Iraq, $87 billion. So this is all money that you and I provided, right? And this is all going to these corporations. So this is supposed to prime the pump. This is supposed to create jobs and move the economy with this accelerator effect. For every dollar the government spends, well, then it gives it, somebody gets employed and then they go out and spend it, so it goes through the economy. Except, like everything under Bush, it's a loot fest, L-O-O-T. It's loot gate, essentially. And in the first hour, I was talking about these two congressmen that have been charging Cheney's company, Halliburton, with ripping us all off. Halliburton has charged the government up to $1.70 a gallon for gasoline. I can't believe this. For gasoline that could be bought wholesale in the Persian Gulf for about 71 cents, shipped to Iraq for 25 cents. So what does that mean? 96 cents. Then the fuel is sold in Iraq for 4 to 15 cents a gallon. So we're, do the math here. Look at your taxes, next time at the end of the year, and understand that part of this is just going off into the coffers of Bush's buddies. Democrats.com. But I went to Democrats.com. You got to check this site out. Are you looking at it, Rick Fox? It's got some amazing stuff on it, doesn't it? They got all these bumper stickers, impeach Bush, re-defeat Bush. Remember, he lost last time. Hey, did you hear that whacked-out right-wing religious fanatic, Boykin, General Boykin, that's head of, like, some counter-terror group? He's giving these speeches, and he says, as you people know, George W. Bush did not win the majority of votes of the American people. I'm going, whoa. You know, usually I don't like to say that stuff. And he said, you know why he is in the White House? I'm going, no, he's not going to say it. Because God put him in there. Whew. What if somebody just tuned by this station and they heard that? I go, you know, they just heard that. God put George W. Bush in the White House. So that's all they heard, right? They tuned by, you know, people punch by all these buttons. So they hear that and they go, oh, man, this guy's whacked. Anyways, at Democrats.com, there's this smiling two politicians with a checkered past. Arnold Schwarzenegger and George W. Bush. They're both smiling, and they've got voice balloons. Arnold is saying, America is so forgiving. Did you know my daddy was a Nazi stormtrooper? True, which is true. And then GW is saying, that's nothing. My grandpa Prescott Bush helped finance Adolf Hitler and got rich on Auschwitz slave labor, but Americans will never know because I control the media. Now, if you click on that, am I going where I want? Yeah. Whole thing about Prescott Bush. Hitler's angel, as he was called by newspaper? The Tribune. I'm looking for which one that is this. Anyways, this takes some viewing. And did Prescott Bush steal Geronimo's skull? Yeah, you got to check that one. But anyway, he's got all the books that you might want to read. Michael Moore's new one, Dude, Where's My Country? Man, they've got them all here, don't they? But anyways, one of them is what we're talking about, called black box voting. And that's how these right-wingers control this new system of touchscreen voting. All right, let's get back to your calls. We'll do David Rovics in 15 minutes. All right, it's a lot of time to talk to you. Hi, WRIF, it's Peter Werbe. You're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, Pete. It's Howard from Grass Lake.
Hi, Howard.
Hey, you've been on for 30 years. I listened to you during Vietnam.
Really?
And yeah,
I was out at the Grass Lake Rock Festival.
Yeah, I know. Anyhow, reason I called, people that can't make it to your protest down there in Washington, got an alternative. We can go up to Friday, go up to the Capitol in Lansing. They're going to have a UN protest up there. Protest the takeover of this country by the UN. They've got control of our parks now, national parks. And
they do.
What about, yeah.
I missed that.
Yeah. Well, through the...
Our national parks.
Biosphere projects. The heritage rivers, that's all UN controlled.
Really?
Yeah, there's plaques in it in parks. You got to look for them because they're hidden. But the UN flag flies over all our national parks, flies over the Capitol, probably all the states. So,
Howard, are you sure? I mean, I will check this out. I think I'm going to go to the Capitol. I don't think I'm going to find the UN flag over the Capitol.
Yeah, I think you will.
All right, well, we can't argue about facts.
Okay, anyhow, there's going to be an anti-UN rally up there, 9 to 1 Friday.
Yeah.
And they're flying in Sheriff Richard Mack from Arizona. He's going to be speaking. And I'd like to have people show up if they can. We need a turnout up there this year.
Thank you, Howard.
Yeah.
Appreciate it. He's one of these guys that goes way back with me. Thank you. Appreciate your call. 313-298-WRIF. Hi, this is Night Call. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. This is Tim.
I was just thinking, I've been to a lot of national parks. I don't think I've ever seen the United Nations flag.
I don't think I have either.
No.
I just want to say, thank God someone in Detroit has their eyes open, like you.
I mean, on the media, because there's...
Right.
It's not like...
And Bush doesn't control you, which
yeah,
is cool.
Yeah,
yeah. I have Michael Moore's new book, and I must say it is a very intelligent read. I've been a pretty avid Michael Moore fan for the last couple of years.
Uh-huh.
And it's nice to see that somebody like him stands up for people like me and you. I'm t- two going to Washington, D.C. this weekend.
Are you good? I thought, you know, I was getting afraid that there wasn't going to be many people going.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I live in a very Republican city, Port Huron.
Yeah.
And it's rough.
I thought we called it Port Huron, isn't that it?
Port Huron, yeah.
Yeah.
There
you go.
It's just rough to live. I mean, I'm not Democratic, but I vote Democratic.
Mm-hmm.
Just because if I voted the way I would just throw my vote away.
Well, I certainly don't consider myself a Democrat.
But I'm just glad that I wish more people would just read more of Michael Moore's stuff. It's just he's very smart, but yeah. People see his Oscar speech and they think he's a big fat idiot.
Well, by the way, when you talk about people like myself or Michael Moore standing up for people, you know, in a lot of ways, I mean, I don't consider myself real different from you. I just, you know, like, you know, if you're a big entertainer or something like that, or you're like, you know, like, what's that dope addict's name, Rush Limbaugh? I mean, he really did think of himself as something special. In fact, can you imagine if I was on here and was just bragging about myself in the manner that he does, how I would probably have about zero listeners. But, you know, they these conservatives, the ditto heads, they love to worship at the feet of power, even though these people, when they get down to the feet, they're clay. The feet are made of clay, right?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, can you imagine worshiping George Bush or Rush Limbaugh and what they all turn out to be? I mean, they're all a pack of frauds.
And unfortunately, I got a bad feeling that George Bush will get reelected just because America's too stupid to see how much of an idiot he is.
Well, I said earlier that George W. Bush would not bomb, or no, I'm giving away what I was going to say, would not invade Cuba. I predict that by September or October 2004, George W. Bush will either bomb Iran or Cuba. They will do. Yeah.
That'd be the biggest mistake I think he'll ever make.
Well,
president.
See, he's screwed now because his popularity came when he was able to make people very fearful, or we were very fearful. It's the only time his ratings were good. When we got our senses back, or when the fear and anger passed to some extent, as it always will, then is you know, people start thinking, wait a minute, what is this guy doing? And that's why his poll numbers are dropping. So he was able to be successful only around acts of terror or acts of war. Well, George W. Bush says, I've just discovered weapons of mass destruction in fill-in-the-blank. People aren't going to buy it. And for one thing, there's not enough of the United States Armed Forces to be able to carry out another war. So what about another terrorist attack? I don't think that's going to work well for him either because people are going to say, wait a minute, you're supposed to be the big father figure that was supposed to protect us from this. So he's kind of screwed no matter what happened, which is wonderful. So don't be too pessimistic.
I won't. But thanks a lot for taking my call.
Sure, thank you. Thanks for joining me. I will see you in Washington. We're talking about, pardon me, now I'm beginning to talk like the Godfather. Hold on, folks. There we go. You know, this starts happening. Around this time of year. And in fact, I better get somebody on the air, and then I will cough off, you know, off mic. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air.
Hi, Pete.
Hi.
Great show tonight.
Thank you.
I just wanted to put my 2 cents in on, I guess, a little more economics, even though we've been talking about it, it can get confusing. I just wanted to make a point. A lot of people, I don't think, since we've lived so long, in this kind of free market fantasy of the Republicans and even the Democrats kind of participate to some degree, I think people have to start thinking that we're entering a phase of civilization that we really haven't seen before. We've got 6 billion people on the planet. We're all using water, consuming resources, and capitalism, the consumer-driven economy, is just making that more intensive. And especially with oil, we've got maybe 40 years or less of the mass availability of oil at the rate we're using it. And without some kind of economic planning, a cooperative planning, society and economy and our economy will collapse at some point. The government is needed, a cooperative government, a government that represents the people, is needed to set priorities that will help society think for the long term. Free market capitalism is largely
people need to see, it's largely about short-term exploitation. The wealth created is frequently transitory, and it comes at the expense of common natural and social well-being. Americans, they need to break their short-term kind of TV soundbite, Dow Jones stock market thinking, and begin to ask the question, how will these policies, of, like the Bush administration, affect my children 20 years from now and my neighbor's children?
Sure.
And the policies now aren't necessarily about greed. They're about consolidating wealth and power in the hands of a few and undermining democracy by reducing us from stakeholders and producers into consumers who are indebted and can't make real choices. With free market capitalism, the people who have the wealth create the choices for everyone else. And as resources grow scarcer, the elites need more control. That's basically my point.
Well, yeah, I mean, I certainly think, you know, you're on to something. I don't want to say it like that. I mean, I think you're absolutely correct. And what's happened is, you know, for every revolution, now I said I'm going to play this David Rovick song after the revolution, but for every revolution, there's a counter-revolution. And the antecedents, really, of Bushko, of the Bush gang, are really the Tories that that did not want the formal implantation of democracy on this continent, and they fought against it, and they ran off to Canada and what have you, and all the way along, throughout our history, when there's been an extension of the Democratic Revolution that began in 1776 to include other people. The counter-revolution and the counter-revolutionaries were always there. Now, this is what's happened again. Bush wants to roll back the idea that decision-making under the democratic process is extended, and he wants to reassert the ability of elites to make the major decision. He wants to manipulate things. But, you know, people say, well, he's going to rule as a fascist, like a fascist government. He doesn't have to. What he's doing is, and I mean, this is true with a lot of modern government, is that they want to, in Noam Chomsky's phrase, they want to manufacture consent. The way they do that is absolute control of the media. And nothing has convinced the American elites of the necessity of absolutely controlling the media than what's happened to Tony Blair in England. Because when they had an energetic opposition press, like they do, well, damn, I mean, Tony Blair's popularity goes in the toilet, and now, since there's actually blood in the water, is that people, that the whole Bush House of Cards is beginning to fall apart, the loyal reporters all of a sudden are, lo and behold, beginning to criticize Bush. Imagine that. Thank you so much. Appreciate your call. Let's take another call or so, and then we'll get David Robix on. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, Peter. This is Matt. I'm getting into the automotive field, and I had a comment to make. When Al Gore was running, he said that he was going to try and be less oil independent.
Dependent, yeah.
Yeah, and the way Bush is running this thing is he wants us to make the cars lighter, you know, less, you know, better gas mileage, but he doesn't fund that, you know, the automotive field or anything like that, and I think that's bullshit. And I don't know. I saw the movie Bowling for Columbine, thought it was a great, great movie. Anybody who hasn't seen it, always encourage people to see it.
Apparently the DVD that's out, you can go to michaelmoore.com, it has all these scenes that weren't in the movie. And, you know, also that he is getting out, supposedly, another documentary about Bush, specifically about Bush, before the election. He hopes to have it out in June. Wow, that ought to be great. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate it. And, yeah, we got time for another call. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, Peter, my name's Mark. I used to call you 20 years ago.
Really?
Yeah, it's been good to hear you all this time.
Well, thank you.
I just wanted to, I had this list here of seven points concerning fascism, sort of defining it. Concentrated private control of wealth,
yep.
Control of information,
mm-hmm.
Stringent socioeconomic controls,
right.
Suppression of the opposition through terror and censorship, belligerent nationalism and racism, suppression of labor movement, massive manufacture of arms. And the guy who had contributed this, his observation on the list was, I think we're past the early stage.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know, we've hit every one of those exactly, but either we have or we're pretty close to it.
Yeah, and it's been, I mean, by stealth. People, and it's been under the guise of patriotism, rah-rah patriotism.
Mm-hmm.
Defense against terror. Why, you can't be a, you're not against the war on terror, are you, citizen?
Yeah. Well, I think this.
I hope it wakes people up. I hope it gets people out in the streets and demonstrating again. Like, I hope it gets people more politically aware. I hope they start realizing what's happened to their country. This has been a fascist takeover. This cabal of warmongering idiots that got us. We're in horrible messes in Colombia, Afghanistan, Iraq, the Philippines, and they want to pretend like. It's not happening that way.
Yeah, actually, we're at war in Colombia for all practical purposes as well. Mark, thank you so much.
Hey, Peter, have a good night.
Don't wait Don't wait another 20 years.
No, I won't.
All right, thank you so much. And did I have? I had one more thought. Maybe not. Oh yeah, that was. In fact, it's good to know that a number of you are going off to Washington for the Saturday, October 25th, March Against War and Occupation. Bring the troops home now. Let's use the money for that Bush is squandering on his corporate buddies to make this country what it should. Now, I will look. Howard said that there's a UN flag over the Capitol. I will check it out. I'll report to you next week. In the meantime, let's go out with this David Rovix, a new song. It's davidrovix.com. R-O-V-I-C-S is where you can go to it. And, well, I'll just, we'll play it and then I'll be back just to say goodbye.
Was a time I'll always remember. I could never forget how reality came down around us like some Western movie set. When the dust all settled, the sun shone so bright, and a great calm took over us like it was all gonna be alright. That's how it felt to be alive. Workers talked of solidarity and refused to build weapons of war. No more will we make missiles. We're gonna do something different. And for the first time, their children were proud of their parents. Somewhere in Gaza, a little boy smiled and cried. After the swung open, mothers hugged their sons. The Liberty Bell was ringing when the cops put down their guns. A million innocent people lit up in the springtime air. And Mumi and Leonard and Sarah Jane Olson took a walk in Tompkins Square. And they talked about what they'd do. Left their faces, went back to their families. A non-aggression treaty was signed with every sovereign state. All the terrorist groups disbanded with no empire left to hate. And they all started planting olive trees. After the Bush and Henry Kissinger were sent off to the world court. Their plans for global domination were preemptively cut short. Their weapons of mass destruction were inspected and destroyed. Battleships dismantled, never again to be deployed. And the world breathed a sigh of relief after the revolution. Solar panels were on the rooftops, trains upon the tracks, organic food was in the markets, no GMOs upon the racks. And all the billionaires had to learn how to share. Was told to quit his whining when he said it wasn't fair. And his mansion became a collective farm after the revolution. All the political poets couldn't think of what to say, so they all decided to live life for today. I spent a few years catching up with all my friends and lovers, sleeping till 11 home beneath the covers. And I learned how to play the accordion after the
WRIF, the Peter Werbe Show, Night Call, David Rovics, R-O-V-I-C-S, davidrovics.com, brand new album called Return. And if you think, wow, that was too radical, just think about John Lennon's old tune, Imagine, maybe even more radical, huh? Anyway, this is available, brand new from David. Some of it, though, I mean, this has this kind of joyous, visionary quality to it, but there's other stuff about the Middle East. It's almost heart-wrenching to listen to. David Rovics, one of the great folk singers of this era. He's going to be down in Miami. There you can go, well, yeah, we got to end this part of the show, don't we, I think. Anyways, there's these big demonstrations against the Free Trade Area of the Americas, sponsored in part by the AFL-CIO. I'm going to be down there. I'm going to hook up with David. I'll tell you all about that as the weeks continue. That's in the middle of November. All right, I'm going to Washington. I'll give you a report when I come back next Sunday. Stay tuned for the interviews.
Buying a home? Tired of wasting your valuable time scouring the newspapers and home magazines? Want to search thousands of homes for sale in one spot? Then you need Home Quarters at HQRealEstate.com. Every available listing in Southeast Michigan is just a click away. Detailed information, photos, search tools, and property alerts, so you'll be the first to know when your perfect home becomes available. Home Quarters is powered by local real estate professionals. Just go to HQRealEstate.com. Home Quarters. Your next move starts here. Selling your home? Want more buyers to know your home is for sale?
Want to save money too?
Then you need Home Quarters. More buyers will see your home when you list with Home Quarters. Home Quarters is powered by local real estate professionals, and our low commissions will save you thousands of dollars. Maximum exposure,
maximum savings.
Go to HQRealEstate.com or call right now, 888-615-9995. That's 888-615-9995. Home Quarters. Your next move starts here.
Hi. Thanks for calling Comcast High Speed Internet. Are you calling about our special offer?
Hello. Yes. This is John Smith.
Okay. Mr. Smith, how did you hear about us?
My hard drive. My grandmother told me about your service. Nana told me it's up to 25 times faster than dial-up, and always on. I want to be that fast. Oops. My computer wants to be that fast.
Are you sure you're not a computer?
What? That is crazy talk, sir. How could, whoops, there goes my stomach. I have to go now. I'm disconnecting. I mean, I have hockey practice.
Computers will do anything to get Comcast high-speed internet. Sign up now and get 6 months for just $19.99 a month. Call 1-888-COMCAST. Offer ends November 30th. Restrictions apply. Download speed compared to 56K dial-up. Installation fees apply. Call for pricing and service details.
Every 80 seconds, a teenager gives birth.
Not mine, I said.
My girl is perfect.
My boy wouldn't do that.
That couldn't happen to my family.
But it did.
It did. My daughter got pregnant.
My son is a father.
My child has AIDS.
40% of 15-year-olds are sexually active.
What are they thinking?
How will he take care of a child?
How will she go to college?
How long before AIDS kills my child?
I didn't think this could happen to her.
To him.
To me.
To us.
Don't let it happen to you.
Tell your child that sex can wait.
That they can ruin their life.
They can get pregnant.
They can get AIDS.
They can die.
So give them the love they need.
Be involved.
Tell them the risks.
Show them you care.
Talk till you're blue.
They will listen.
They will listen.
And they won't be another statistic.
Call 1-800-454-8041 for a free Sex Can Wait packet. That's 1-800-454-8041. A message from the Michigan Department of Community Health and the Michigan Association of Broadcasters.
Have you ever had a bad experience at the dentist? A lot of people are afraid of the dentist. Others just don't have the time. Then when they finally do go, there's a lot of work to be done, and it makes them even more afraid or embarrassed. Hi, I'm Dr. Abe Krishanowitz. With Sedation Dentistry, we can make it easier for you to have years' worth of damage repaired in just a few visits. It is simple. And regardless of how many years of neglect you've been through because of fear or lack of time, we will help you achieve healthy teeth and gums for a lifetime. You've put off going to the dentist long enough. Don't wait any longer. What I'd like you to do right now is call 586-247-0010. That's 586-247-0010. Or visit us on the web at mydentistry.com. We've changed people's lives. We can do the same for you. No matter how long you've waited because of fear or lack of time, we will help you. You thought about doing it. This is your opportunity. Call now, 586-247-0010, and receive your initial exam and x-rays for only $19.
Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby, on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Good morning. Thank you very much for joining me. It's a pleasure to be with you once again and to bring you some interesting authors on this program, The Peter Werby Show. Joining me now is Stephen Watson, a fabulous book, a look at that fabled decade of the 1960s through the lens of Andy Warhol and the people around him, the films he made, the people that he came in contact with, the innovative work that came out of that period. The book is called Factory Made, Warhol and the 60s, and I'd also direct you to a related website. It's just called factorymade.org, and it's absolutely fabulous itself. Stephen Watson has written numerous books about the avant-garde, the advanced guard of arts, beginning before World War I. He's written about high bohemia of the 1930s, the Harlem Renaissance, the Beat Generation, and this is culminating with work on the factory. We'll talk about that. That's where Andy Warhol made what he made. Stephen Watson, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you, Peter.
Before we start out talking about Andy Warhol and the factory, tell us about your interest, and I don't think I'm misstating to say almost your fascination with the avant-garde of the art movement. What's that based in?
Well, you know, I mean, it's very interesting talking, first of all, to a Detroit audience. I'm a Midwest boy, Mound, Minnesota, in fact, so totally, in some way, totally outside this, and I think we all become obsessed with what we don't have.
Okay.
And so this was something by the time I was a senior in high school in 1966, I was already fascinated with the Warhol factory.
Mm-hmm.
So sort of while it was happening. And the whole experience of writing the book is I'm now coming back many years later, interviewing these people and kind of putting it together. But, you know, what I said, I think we all want what we don't
Well, give me the larger context, though, because this is almost a book in a series about the avant-garde,
the advance guard
of the arts.
Okay,
yeah.
I have written, you know, as you said so well, about pre-World War One, the Harlem Renaissance, the Beat Generation. All of these people, and it's not just people, it's groups, it's circles, have been very interested in it, both aesthetically and in terms of how we live our lives. They've been pioneers. And I think it's really important and fascinating. To me, fascinating.
Well, certainly, Andy Warhol, fascinating on lots of different levels. Honored recently with a stamp. And
yep.
So people think they know Andy Warhol because he did the soup cans, and he
yep.
did Marilyn Monroe, and he did, and then kind of maybe it begins to decrease greatly in terms of people's information and knowledge. Maybe I can start you off, Stephen Watson, in your book, Factory Made Warhol in the 60s, by giving, and this is odd to do in a sense, I mean, sort of a negative spin. I was with a prominent sculptor yesterday, and he was showing me his work, and I mentioned that I was going to interview you. And I thought he'd react positively, and he just kind of got a scowl on his face, and he said, oh, Warhol was a fraud. If he was a fraud, he was a magnificent fraud. But, that's always haunted him. Oh, you put soup cans on a canvas and sold it for X number of dollars.
Okay.
Tell me about this.
So, I mean, let me respond. I think it's, first of all, it's a good question. I think it's always a good kind of open question to think about, you know, what are the reasons things are done for? And Warhol has always been accused of that. In my own sense is, as I moved through the research for this book, I felt more and more how adventurous he was. And also, you know, that he did things that were not commercially very viable, that there was something that was really very interesting about doing things that were chaotic and unusual. And we all think we know Warhol because we know the soup can.
Right.
You know, there's a sense everybody in America owns Warhol because they know the basic icon. But there is a side that I look at in Factory Made that it's really pretty different than the usual sense of all this.
Tell us some about the factory. I mean, that phrase, factory made.
Okay.
Tell us about the factory.
Okay. In general, the factory was a place, very specifically, East 42nd Street, former hat factory, from 1964 to 1968. It was the place where Warhol shot films, silkscreen canvases, recorded a novel, you know, did all sorts of things. It was completely done in silver foil and silver paint. It was a kind of installation, both, you know, physically, but psychologically and socially. And this is what I love. It was a place where anything could happen, and it did, and it was recorded.
Yeah.
And that's an amazing thing. So it's the fact when I say the factory, it's both a physical place, but it's also something kind of larger.
Mm-hmm. Well. You know why I just kind of react badly when someone says, "Oh, Andy Warhol was a fraud. Anybody could have put soup cans on a canvas. Nobody did." That's the first thing. Secondly, when something energizes so many people, as I mean, just the front cover of Factory Made, Warhol in the 60s,
uh-huh.
and you see, I can't even count them quickly, 12, 15 people
yeah.
surrounding the always enigmatic Warhol, who is what? He's got a camera up and he's taking a photograph of the photographer.
Exactly. I love the cover.
Yes, it is wonderful.
Yeah.
I mean, how self I mean, it all seemed so self-conscious, though, in a manner that that normally you don't associate with the arts. I mean, that's kind of a vague question.
Well, I mean, let me just say, I think the 60s was a time of lots of kinds of experimentation. And the Warhol films, which dominated, you know, the mid-60s, they were totally about experimentation, i.e., what would happen if you turned the camera on for 3 minutes and the subject could do whatever they wanted to?
Mm-hmm.
So it's about, part of it is, it's about exploring things. I don't think we have to say, oh, that's really great art, about any specific thing. I think that the idea, though, of exploring and seeing what things look like is very important.
Well, now,
it's a kind of play.
Yeah. Use that phrase, great art. I mean, last time I went to the Museum of Modern Art, I think it was, there were Andy Warhol paintings in there. So
there's lots of Andy Warhol paintings.
Yeah, I'm just trying to remember which.
I think, you know, the financial verdict is in on Warhol's art. It continues to sell incredibly. He's in museums, definitely. What are not so well known are the collaborative things he did in the mid-60s. And that's, you know, exemplified by the film.
Mm-hmm. Now, I read in your book, Factory Made, my guest is its author, Stephen Watson, that he made 500 films?
Yes.
I assume they weren't all feature length.
No. You know, most of those, many of those are 3-minute so-called screen tests. And what that meant was that people that came to the factory, he invited them to sit for 3-minute screen tests. They would sit with a stable camera, and they could do whatever they wanted. So, you know, in addition to that, there's very long things like Empire, an unmoving shot of the Empire State Building.
Just the camera trained on, yeah.
Narrative films like Lonesome Cowboys. There's, you know, there's a variety of things. But part of, you know, he was very interested in moving so that he did new things all the time.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is what I mentioned earlier, Stephen Watson, that there was that there is a stamp out now honoring Andy Warhol, and they're on these sheets. I'm sure you've seen them, and they have this sort of typical Warholian pensive look, and this absolutely astounding quote. The astounding in the sense that it comes from the U.S. government. Andy Warhol is quoted on the sheet of stamps: "If you want to know all about Andy Warhol, just look at the surface of my paintings and films and me, and there I am. There's nothing behind it." Well, we spent 100 years prior to that looking beneath the surface of everything. That was modernism, and you know, everything Picasso, that whole modern art movement, examined what is beneath the surface. Suddenly here's Andy Warhol, quintessential postmodern, saying, "This is it." And so he's always enigmatic. I mean, any sense yourself what was beneath the surface, or was he telling the truth?
Well, I think a lot of what is that he was telling the truth. Number one, he loved to look at for a long time at the images. I sincerely do not think he had any conscious philosophical thesis behind this.
Mm-hmm.
This is a man who is, you know, quote-unquote cognitively impaired, i.e. doesn't read much, doesn't like that, comes to things through images, comes to things through looking. He loves looking. He's infatuated with looking. So it's, you know, it's not about in his case, I think about thinking, oh, this means this. I think it's about, this is my infatuation, and I'm going to show it to you.
Now, in your book, Factory Made, Warhol in the 60s, because we see the public life of Andy Warhol. In fact, the photographs, and I see here it lists 130 black and white photograph film stills and snapshots by, you know, the people that surrounded him. It almost seems like he had no private life, that his entire life was public. I mean, is that just the you know, one's easy perception, or was there also a private Andy Warhol?
Well, I think he had, you know, 80% of his life was very public. I think the private life, there's a lot that you do not see. You know, when we say private life, we sometimes think, oh, that means love life.
Mm-hmm.
And he had, I would say, a number of boyfriends. It's not a terribly intimate situation. I think the energy is mostly in the public life.
Hmm. Now, is any of this ever said with this? I mean, it seemed to me some of the stuff was said with a great sense of irony, at least to what he wrote, or maybe he just dictated and was printed. I was thinking of, I think it was in the magazine High Times, where there was an essay over his name that was called "Why I Love to Live Fast." Have you seen that?
Remind me.
Okay, well, in he says, "I love to live fast." He says, my favorite clothing is a jumpsuit, because you can jump out of bed and jump right into it.
Yes.
He said, he had a bunch of things, but one of them was, my favorite kind of sex is premature ejaculation. And, you know, he went on like this. And whereas he was saying, this is what I like, it seemed more of a critique of modern life, that it's way too sped up. So is there cynicism and irony there, or is it again?
I think there's not irony.
Oh, that's amazing.
You know, my own sense of this is, you know, when he gave public interviews, there was a combination of a mask, but partially that mask is just telling the dumb, literal truth,
mm-hmm,
as he saw it.
What energized him and the people around him? I mean, let me maybe put it a little clearer. I mean, there were so many people around him. He had so many different projects.
Yeah, let's talk about some names.
Yeah, let's go ahead. Let me just reintroduce you. Stephen Watson is my guest, and brand new from Pantheon Books, Factory Made, Warhol in the 60s, to get a good look at it. And I think you said before our interview off air, Stephen Watson, that if you go to factorymade.org, the website, there's many of the people you interviewed, and you get other voices in this.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I mean, for me, it's like really exciting to be able to do a website where it is video of the interviews I did with the factory people. So you can read the book, but the other side is you see the people, their body language and the way they express themselves. And, you know, when I say the other people, the factory was an extraordinary range, from people like the Betsy Johnson, the fashion designer, to Lou Reed of the Velvet Underground, and John Cale, and Billy Name, who silvered the factory, and Taylor Mead, who performed in many of the movies, and Viva, who performed, and International Velvet, and, you know, one could go on and on. But it's a lot of people.
Now, I remember, you know, this station is a rock and roll station, and many, many people are familiar, and probably most of the audience, with Lou Reed and the Velvet Underground. And as I remember, the first album, didn't it say, like, Andy Warhol presents the Velvet Underground?
A very quick version of that story John Cale and Lou Reed and Sterling Morrison and Mo Tucker were playing in Greenwich Village, and Warhol came to them with Paul Morrissey. very interested, and they decided to produce them. At that point, the Velvet Underground was completely unknown. They produced the first album, the Velvet Underground and Nico, with the great, you know, Banana. And they performed in the East Village at the Dom in April 1966. So that's now a completely legendary album.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to remind people that when you said with the Banana, it has a Warhol cover with a banana that it can actually, you can take the peel off. And what are they worth now? I actually have one. Never mind. I wouldn't part with it.
I don't know, but I've got a lot.
I would say I'm not going to get rid of any of my nostalgic album or items unless it's in the thousands. I do have my price. Andy Warhol actually did, if I remember correctly, did connect his name up directly.
Andy connected his name whenever he could.
Yeah, okay.
You know, I mean, I don't mean that in a bad way, but he was totally about that. There was one point where he put an ad in the Village Voice saying, you know, Andy Warhol will present positive compliments about film, whips, musical instruments, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So he was totally interested in doing that. But part of what fascinated me was that he could find the people and the groups that were central, really central to that moment.
Well, that is the key. And as we said coming into this, your interest in the avant-garde, the advance guard of art movements. And, I mean, what is this? I mean, some of these questions I realize are so broad, but when there is an avant-garde, what does it leave when it's no longer the avant-garde? I mean, what kind of cultural patterns, for instance, does Andy Warhol and so many people around him, what's left after that period that you write about in the 1960s?
Well, I mean, first of all, I think in terms of what they leave, first of all, it's not like anybody leaves models like, oh, live like me, but they do leave something that's really important for the imagination for several generations younger.
Mm-hmm.
A sense of experimentation, a sense of, you know, we are not all alike. We are not all commercial. We are not all lots of things. And that's, to me, just in the broad way, really useful.
What do you hope? I mean, obviously, anybody that goes to the efforts that you have to print factory-made Warhol in the 60s, I mean, it must have been an enormous amount of work. It's a 500-page book. It's extraordinarily attractive with its 130 photographs, a lot of marginalia with all sorts of information as you read along. And, I mean, every author's dream, of course, is that, quote, everybody would buy it. But on the other hand, does this fit into what you just said that, I mean, I would think that you would hope that a lot of younger people would not use so much Andy Warhol as a model, but the idea of going beyond what's prescribed now.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, as I say, no, but it's not like I ever think, oh, copy Andy Warhol, oh, copy this one or that one. But I really believe that the sense of experiment and self-discovery and opening up and, you know, in that kind of broad way is really useful.
Mm-hmm. Now, factory made, as we said, refers to the factory where so much of what Andy Warhol and his friends put together in everything from dance, poetry, film, rock and roll, and lots of other experimental items for that era. And you talk about it began in 1964 and it ended in 1968 with a very, very dramatic event. Maybe you could, just as we come to the end of this interview, Stephen Watson, tell us what happened.
Sure. Yes, it was an exactly frightening conservative era, there was a woman named Valerie Solanas, who some of your listeners know is the subject of I Shot Andy Warhol, and that is exactly what she did. That's a complicated story, but on June 3rd, 1968, she shot Warhol. He was dead for 1.5 minutes, came back to life, and it ended a certain era and began another era.
Mm-hmm. Now, Valerie Solanas, she wrote what was called the Scum Manifesto, the Society for Cutting Up Men, and she, rather than just being rhetoric, she didn't cut it. So she moved this into practice. Why did she see Andy Warhol, of all the perhaps who she could identify as sexist figures, if he was, as a particular target?
Well, I would say, first of all, it's in this case, I don't think it really is about sexism. I think Valerie was, first of all, very smart, very funny, and also very paranoid schizophrenic.
Mm-hmm.
And she saw Warhol as a kind of controlling figure. And in the paranoid scheme, he fit in. I don't think it was about, you know, some people said it was because he lost her play. But I think it's more that she identified him with a certain kind of power.
Mm-hmm. And I've not made it through your book. In fact, I've just been skimming through it and centering on particular areas of it. So I didn't see in here whether you were able to interview. I don't even know whether she's still alive.
No, not alive.
Oh, okay.
No, she died in 1988.
All right. Well, we are out of time, and how I know it sounds well. That's why you. That's
amazing.
That's why you wrote
a Peter. You talk well.
Well, thank you very much. That's why you wrote a 500-page book, though, Stephen Watson, because it would.
And I just want to say there was one point where I was asked to cut 100 pages.
No, no, no.
You know, because it's a very, very big story.
Mm-hmm.
And I really, you know, attempted to not make it long, but it's a very big story.
It is.
And in my mind, a really important one.
And I think that you've done a marvelous job. Arthur Danto says, the best imaginable book on the 60s of Andy Warhol, Silver Factory, The Exploding Plastic Inevitable, and the Appropriation by Mainstream Culture of the Underground Avant-Garde. My guest has been Stephen Watson. The book is Factory Made, Warhol and the 60s. It's published by Pantheon. And remember, too, you can get a look at some of the people that my guest actually interviewed. If you go to factorymade.org, it's also on my website as well. Thank you so much, Stephen Watson.
Thank you.
around here, the radio station you're listening to, that has to do with trying to find out what public issues are of concern to our audience. It's called ascertainment. In other words, we find out, we ascertain what are issues that you're concerned about for our community, for our state, for your neighborhood, for your family. And one of the big ones always is the economy. And that is about jobs, what they pay, whether we're going to have one, what's the future of our economy here in the United States and throughout North America. And I know a couple of times when I interviewed Steve Jokic, who's the late president of the United Auto Workers, in the last years of his life, he was tremendously concerned always with what he called, and properly called, the deindustrialization of the United States. That is, the industrial jobs that in many ways served as the basis for communities like Detroit and Flint were simply disappearing. They were going mainly overseas, and he had a lot of strategies, I probably have to say none that have been too successful, in keeping industry in our area. Well, and I say that partly to illustrate that he began talking about in the last couple of years. Our guest in the studio this morning is Stephen High. He's written a book called Industrial Sunset, The Making of North America's Rust Belt, 1969 to 1984. So we're talking about the roots of a problem that that are longstanding. And Stephen High, among other things, is, you tell me, I thought I was looking for where you teach at the university now.
At the University of Nipissing in North Bay, Ontario.
That's right, and that's where you live now as well. Steve High is in town for the Detroit Labor Conference, and welcome to the broadcast.
Hi, Peter, thanks.
So what I said in my introduction, when we're talking about deindustrialization, this is nothing that's happened in the last three or four years.
It's a long-standing process that goes back decades.
Okay. And give us some background. I mean, why 1969? Why not 1968 or 1958? I mean, why that particular year?
The book is, at one level, the book is about the hardships and loss felt by industrial workers between 1969 and 1984. And the reason why I chose those years is because we see two great waves of plant closings that sweep across the continent. From 69 about 72, and a far greater wave that sweeps across the continent from 79 to 84. If I can give a couple of
sure,
stats.
Do.
From 69 to 76, 22.3 million North Americans lost their jobs to plant closings.
Oh.
So we're talking about a mass experience that many, many families have gone through. Another stat from 1963 to 82, 100,000 individual factories, each employing at least 19 workers, went down. So again, when we talk about plant closings and job loss and deindustrialization, we're talking about something that many, many people know a heck of a lot about.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, you saw how shocked I was by those statistics, and I like to think of myself as being aware of the process in the city that I've lived in, and we've seen the physical results of it. We once had this thriving city of 2 million. Now it's below 1 million, and, so much open space, very little industry. You can barely call it the Motor City anymore. I always call it the Pizza City because, all these pizza guys are here. In a sense, it was almost like a revolution, but a stealth one to some extent, other than the people that actually suffered it.
Absolutely. Like, it's interesting. I'm 35 years old now, and I still remember 1989-90 when with the fall of communism, and the images that come to my mind are people pulling down the statues of Marx and Lenin. And people at that time knew that this was an end of an era,
right,
and an end of a political age. And I think we can look at industrial America in the same way, in the sense that we've all seen images on TV of demolitions of blast furnaces or of smokestacks. Like I know there was what, the Twin Sisters, was that it?
No, the Seven Sisters.
Seven Sisters,
yeah,
that's
right,
it, yeah.
Right.
And so this is almost like a ritualized type thing where you're almost imposing order on something that's inherently not orderly at all. Like, deindustrialization is messy, and a lot of people, of course, fall victim to it. And so absolutely, I think you're right.
With that massive job loss and dislocation, I mean, we have been in a recession here in the States for about the last 3 years or so. But say all through the Clinton era, people thought, maybe it was based on sort of a false wealth in terms of what we saw in those dot-com companies. But did the economy successfully compensate for all that? I mean, for all practical purposes, it looked to have, particularly when you go back to that era, you said 69 to 72.
Well, in a way, we're still, of course, we're still living with plant closings, mm-hmm. and you're right. Certainly, with the collapse of the new economy in the last few years, and all those job losses in high tech, it's many of the same things that industrial workers, automotive workers, steel workers were experiencing, and still are experiencing today. And you mentioned like the donut hole effect in terms of Detroit. Well, we can look at Akron, Ohio. You know, the rubber city, rubber capital of the world,
right.
No longer makes tires.
They don't.
Also, you can look at Pittsburgh. You know, the steel city, the steel city, the Steelers, no longer make steel. And so, what happens to a steel town without steel? What happens to an auto town where you no longer make automotive?
Walmart's.
Walmart's. You make one. Yeah, that's right. But these auto workers, of course, are then becoming working at a Walmart. Right.
That's
they're forced to shift gears, and it's not only a paycheck issue. I spoke to 137 people who lost their jobs in the United States and Canada.
In writing the book.
Yeah. And what they told me over and over again was that these jobs meant far more to them than a paycheck, that this was a place that their friends were there, their identities were formed there, especially long service workers who'd spent, 20, 25 years in a plant. And so when that plant goes down, often with no warning whatsoever and no real explanation, it takes a lot out of you. And I think we sometimes forget that.
Well, I know in this book, Industrial Sunset, The Making of North America's Rust Belt, Stephen High, that it's not just a lot of statistics that, as you said, you interviewed 137 workers. Tell us maybe a story or two that actually gave you... that kind of maybe could frame some of this.
Well, there's one steel worker in Buffalo, worked at Republic Steel, and he told me a story where he saw the news that the plant was going down, and he gets a call from his superintendent, and his superintendent says, "Hey, we've got this 35-year pin for you, 35 years of service. Do you still want it?" And this fellow goes, "Well, sure." And so the superintendent goes, "Well, come on down to the factory, and I'll give it to you." And so this fellow comes down to the factory, and, of course, the gates are all locked, and the superintendent comes out to the gate and passes this pin through the chain-link fence.
Oh, wonderful. What an image.
And these are the kinds of stories that you hear over and over again of workers, again, showing up to work one day to find the gate locked, and a little note saying, gone south. And so workers have not been given their due, I think.
Well, you certainly chronicle within your book, Industrial Sunset, the efforts to stop this. And I thought it was very interesting, a lot of the graphics that were, posters and cartoons that were showing the effort that people made to stop what turned out to be an inexorable process. I mean, they couldn't stop it, even for all their efforts. Why couldn't they stop it?
Well, I think... The book is also trying to say that there is hope, that it's of course a very gloomy topic, and there's a lot of hurt and heartache in the story, but people can make a difference. And what I found was that there was a range of responses, political responses to the plant closing problem. What we find, for example, I'll give you two examples. That the first one is in terms of the rates of unionization. Both Canada and the United States, we once saw in the early 1960s a comparable rate of unionization among working people. But by 1986, the rate in Canada was 41%, which was double that of the United States. So the numbers in the United States just collapsed. Why is that?
Mm-hmm.
And the second example I want to give is in terms of plant closing legislation, how politicians respond to this problem. And in Canada, politicians pass a whole load of measures, mandatory severance pay, mandatory advance notice. Companies have to give notice to their workers. Preferential hiring rights is a matter of law. There are placement committees that are mandatory as well to help workers adjust. And this all, of course, doesn't stop plants from closing.
Mm-hmm.
What it does, though, is it softens the impact.
And so none of this in the States.
And in the United States, what happens is we see all kinds of effort to try to get politicians to listen, but almost no action. Only three states, Wisconsin, Maine, and Hawaii, passed any kind of legislation before 1988, and they were not enforced at all. The workers had to go to court to try to enforce these laws, and so what I wonder is why the story is so different, why are the responses so different. So the book is really trying to get into that issue, and what I found was that in the United States, plant closing opponents were divided between the mainstream union movement on the one hand, and sort of a ragtag coalition of consumer advocates, union dissidents, and the new left on the other. And the union movement tended to respond in a fairly business-as-usual way, in the sense that they emphasized the buy Americanism, and they focused on Japanese imports, and they blamed Japanese imports for all the problems.
That was when they were smashing Toyotas.
Yes,
and
every union hall had a sign saying, "Don't park your foreign car here." And why is that? Well, you know, part of the reason is the Cold War and the hunt for communists in the union movement, which put a real sort of break on any kind of radicalism within the union movement in the United States. Part of it is labor law in the United States, where labor law in the United States includes plant closings as a negotiated matter. That meant that unions would sit down and negotiate, but of course they have nothing to bargain with because the plant's gone.
Yeah.
And so what unions got was just maybe a small extension of the health benefits, maybe 2 weeks' pay, just to keep them silent. And so the problem there is the incentive is for unions not to respond politically. One more example,
sure.
In terms of the union movement, the Trade Adjustment Act of '63 gave workers who lost jobs to imports a little bit extra in terms of unemployment benefits
here in the States.
What that meant was. It was a huge incentive for unions to blame every single closure on imports, because that way they can give a little bit extra money for their workers. And again, they let off corporate America off the hook because they were blaming the Japanese, when in fact, you know, there's all kinds of reasons for plants going down.
Well, it's interesting. I knew a union president, and when I would walk in his house to visit his daughter, this is back in the day, he would grab my shirt to see my label to make sure that it said made in the United States. And this was, you know, years and years ago. And I asked him recently, I said, "Bill, how come you don't do this anymore?" And he said, I don't think I can find one. He said, "I'm sure I have shirts that are made in Asia as well." So we have, as you were indicating, I mean, this extraordinarily high number of jobs that have been lost, yet, the employment continues. We're still involved in manufacturing, although it seems every day you hear one of those stories exactly. Mm-hmm. Like you said, was it Syracuse or Schenectady that was the air conditioning capital of North America? The Carrier plant, they are now no longer making any air conditioners in the United States.
And a Canadian example is Bauer, which is a maker of hockey equipment. And it's a name that, like, hockey in Canada.
Come on.
Hockey in Canada,
don't
right?
Tell me.
And that was bought out by Nike. And they've just closed down the last hockey stick factory in Canada. And all that stuff's being made in Asia now. So hockey's been exported itself.
I only laugh because of the irony of it all, because of the tragedy. Now, some people say that, I mean, there's a couple of arguments the way people talk about this. We're in a process of globalization. I mean, there's a lot, we want fair trade, and, you know, that we want, whatever you get. You're going to have this period of readjustment that's hard on a lot of people, that there's a world economy developing in a manner that there hasn't been previously. So there's two arguments. One, that it's an adjustment situation, and that'll take some time. The other one is that essentially that North American workers, Canadian and workers in the States, have priced themselves out of the world market, and the free market has a logic of its own, and you'll go where you can buy labor the cheapest.
You're right. Like certainly with a lot of these footloose, like auto parts sector, for example, they've always gone for cheaper labor. You know, they've moved from the cities into the countryside, from the countryside into the southern United States, from the southern United States into Mexico, and now they're all over the world. But the impulse is the same: is they're going for that cheaper labor. How do you change that? Very, very difficult. I think one of the things I want to say is in Canada, because they got all this legislation, It's more expensive for companies to close plants. because they have all these expenses, severance pay, and all these things, and therefore that is that works against them doing that. It's a disincentive, and so perhaps that in itself is also important. So not only do you soften the blow of displacement, you might actually force companies to really decide, is that something they need to do?
Well, let me give you more of the conservative arguments, and that is that essentially what Canada has done, or what you are advocating in Industrial Sunset, Stephen High, is interfering with the invisible hand of the market, and it works best when it's unrestricted. Even though, like I said, sometimes people will get hurt in the process of readjustment, the market controlled to its utmost would be like the old Soviet Union, where everybody knows it was creaky and inefficient and couldn't meet production norms and what have you. So better a few people should be hurt in this period of readjustment and let the market forces take folks, I don't believe this a bit, but I want to get Steve's reaction.
But nobody's saying that companies should not be allowed to close plants that are unprofitable. What we're saying is that if you're going to do that, you should be treating your workers with respect and dignity for all those decades they put into your company, and they should be loyal to their workers as much as the workers should be loyal to their companies in within a capitalist economy. I don't think that's a contradiction.
No. Well, I certainly think, too, that we're not only talking about unprofitable companies, but companies that just see, I mean, I use that verb, as I'm sure you realize, purposely, buying labor. And companies always want to lower their costs. So if you can get labor for $1 a day rather than $20 an hour, well, yeah. I mean, some of these companies are moving out of Mexico because they can get cheaper labor in Honduras or something like that.
Well, but in Canada, we have a situation where the union movement did respond quite differently from the United States. It's the same unions, right? It's the UAW, or now it's the CAW, Canadian Auto Workers, but the steel workers, the same unions, same companies. But in Canada, unions responded by, for example, playing the nationalistic card, where they would say, well, you know, we're Canadian workers, these are American bosses, American companies are closing our plants. And by using nationalism, they managed to politicize the issue and force government to sort of go on the side of labor and try to regulate it so it's less harsh, that capitalism, you know, still functions, and you're not questioning, you know, management's right to do things, but that they have to do things with a certain moral code.
The book by Stephen High, published by the University of Toronto Press, is Industrial Sunset, The Making of North America's Rust Belt. And, I mean, are we just going to be emptied out of industrial jobs? Because obviously there's people that will do not only industrial jobs, but we find out will be our 800 trouble numbers in India and everywhere else around. And yet it does not look like the end of work in the United States. So, I mean, this world economy is growing apace.
And there's a new reality, too, I think, in the North American industry, where you have plant closing veterans, people who've gone through one, two, perhaps three plant closings. I'm thinking within the big three auto big three, you have workers like Gabriel Solano here in Detroit, whose Fisher Guide plant went down, and then he was recalled because he had recall rights in GM because of the UAW. And when he went into the new plant, he brought his corporate seniority with him, which determined, you know, his wages and his retirement. But he started off with zero plant seniority, which determines the hours you work. So you got afternoon and nights, and then determines your chance of layoff, and it determines your time of holiday. And then you get issues, and so he right away he feels like an outsider in his new plant. Well, before he felt like it was like a home and it was like family. He felt rooted in this place, in the social space of the factory floor. And then afterwards, he's an outsider. And in terms of the United Auto Workers, at his local in Pontiac, in terms of giving their 25-year ring, they only count plant seniority for that. So you have people with 31 years UAW seniority or company seniority not having that ring, which is similar, you know, not that dissimilar from the story I told earlier on in Buffalo with that steel worker getting that pin through that gate. So I think there's all kinds of reasons why people are disillusioned out there.
Well, one thing, I don't know if I asked it as well as I could have, but are we going to be completely deindustrialized?
No. The jobs that are being explored are jobs that are less capital intensive. These are jobs that are unskilled, that are very labor intensive. So not every single industry is going overseas. Like auto assembly, for example, is not going over. Although we have, of course, then we have imports, but there are certain sectors that do, and I do think that is the trend towards sending these kind of jobs overseas. I'm not sure where we go from there.
Well, one of the concerns of, I'm sure, of great numbers, if not almost everyone listening to this, is how secure is their job in the future? And I know you certainly can't predict that, but there are certain social and political economic forces at work, which at least we can look at as an overarching manner and how they're going to affect the future, and that is things like NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, and now the proposal for this free trade area of the Americas, which by its critics, including myself, is called NAFTA on steroids. What does this do to the process of industrial sunset that you write about in your book?
It makes it easier for companies to move from the southern United States, for example, right, where they move from here down to there, to move the next step. Right,
Mexico.
To Mexico, yeah. or to Central America, it's a road, right? And there's different stops along this road towards that cheaper labor. And you start off here in Michigan, and the road goes south. It's I-75, perhaps down to I'm not sure. I-75 goes to Alabama. Say it does.
Georgia.
Okay. Yeah. And it just continues offshore. So again, the impulse is the same, and what I try to do in the book is suggest that companies, these are all foreseeable things. When you build a new plant and you don't reinvest in an older plant, sooner or later that the older plant's going to close, and that can be planned for. And you can plan for moving workers from one place to another within a company. You don't have to abandon people each time you shift production, and we should hold our companies and our corporate executives to account on that.
To be quite blunt, I mean, that seems those don't seem like very radical proposals. I mean, you could obviously pass legislation that says companies can't go. Why not advocate something a little more stringent? Because what we're talking about is not just abstract processes of industrialization or the economy. Or, as you indicate, and it comes out in your book, Industrial Sunset, we're not only talking about the economic lives of our families and our communities and our city, but also the quality of life. Mm-hmm. And it's a pretty radical step for someone to close a plant in Detroit or in where did we say? I remembered Albany or where? Syracuse, and suddenly there's 2,000 workers suddenly without jobs. I mean, that's a pretty radical move on the part of the corporation. And I'm wondering whether or not what you're suggesting is stringent enough to meet the challenge.
Well, I don't know if it's stringent enough. It is what's happening in Western Europe, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Belgium, Germany, France all have this kind of legislation where the company's right to close plants is qualified. It's not total. But should there be some sort of public assessment of company decisions? I don't know. That a lot of people suggest that companies should justify their decisions to close plants, especially with long service workers who are, again, who put in 20 years, who are, say, 50 years old, and they're expected to start again and get retrained into something else. Very, very difficult. And the other thing I want to say is with the oral, the plant shutdown stories told to me, people never saw it coming. Despite all the plants closing down, they still don't see it coming. They look around them on the factory floor for signs of security or insecurity. They, a new piece of equipment is a sign of maybe that there's going to be a job there tomorrow. A layoff notice is a bad thing. And one person told me that it's sort of like a death in the family. You know it's going to come. But when it does come, it doesn't diminish the shock that you feel. And I think that's what happened on this mass scale. When we talk again about 22.3 million North Americans losing their jobs, it's just staggering.
Mm-hmm. More on this in the book itself, Industrial Sunset, The Making of North America's Rust Belt, 1969 to 1984. The author, Stephen High, has been my guest on The Peter Werby Show. It's published by the University of Toronto Press. Stephen, thanks for having joined me.
Thank you.
Night Call is a public affairs presentation of 101 WRIF Detroit. The opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily represent those of the management or sponsors of WRIF Radio. Night Call is hosted every Sunday night by Peter Werby and produced by OD. Stay tuned for more Riff Rock coming right up on 101 WRIF Detroit.
I'm sorry, honey. It's just that we've grown apart. I just don't love you anymore. You know, if we get on with our lives, we'll both feel better. If you move out of the house, we can do this amicably. And honey, I'll let you see the kids anytime you want. Just call me and come over to the house. Or just pick them up. Really, anytime you want. Just trust me.
Think you can trust her? Think she'll let you see the kids anytime you want after she helps you move out of your house and changes the locks? Then think again. This is Attorney Brian Thomas Daly of Daly & Stern at 877-520-1200. If you don't want to lose what you've worked for all your life because your wife doesn't want you,